And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending upon where you are on this rotating, very troubled globe tonight. Welcome to the other side of midnight. As we come on the air tonight, one of the things that we have been warning about and concerned about and apprehensive about is in fact happening. There is a live hot shooting war between Iran and Israel tonight. It may have just concluded in terms of this phase in the middle of the night in Israel, which of course is hours ahead of us because it's around dawn there, a little after 6, approaching 7 a.m. It's 10 o'clock here in the Land of Enchantment. Well, earlier this evening or this afternoon in the United States, depending upon which time zone you're living in, Iran launched a retaliatory strike on the homeland of Israel, the actual territory of Israel, as opposed to third-party surrogates. A few days ago, Israel launched an attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus and killed several high-ranking Iranian generals who have been plotting and planning and architecting the terror responses around the Middle East for many, many years. They have been participating obliquely in Hezbollah's efforts on the north side of Israel during the Israeli-Gaza war. They've been involved in the Gaza war themselves. So anyway, a few days ago, Netanyahu, for some reason, decided to launch a strike against Iranian generals in a third country, in Syria. And tonight's retaliatory response from Iran was in response to that attack, which one can debate the wisdom of these kind of tit-for-tats. But tonight's Iranian strike is not trivial. Something like 200-plus cruise missiles, drones, ballistic missiles, all raining down on Israeli territory. And it was only because of the really superb technological defenses of Israel. That we're hearing that one seven-year-old girl was injured. We don't know the extent of her injuries or how or whatever, but obviously most of the Israeli population during these kinds of attacks, although this is unprecedented, hundreds, like a saturation wave. And fortunately, no one has been injured except for one girl. We don't know the extent of her injuries. This is, of course, coming from the Israeli communications division of the Israeli government. There's no independent confirmation in Israel at the moment, so we're depending upon official sources. But the reason this is leading the news tonight is because the discussion tonight of the eclipse and what has been discovered, both part of this earlier extraordinary event over the U.S., the eclipse, as well as research in the days preceding, following the first successful U.S. unmanned landing on the moon through Intuitive Machines, a private corporation in Houston, not a NASA mission, a NASA participatory mission, because NASA paid something like $108 million to Intuitive Machines to carry, I think, four or five experiments to the moon, which they did and which were successfully completed as experiments. We'll get into some of the details of that later as well. But this has been a several-week period of really amazing developments on the celestial front. So, of course, what I want to do is to provide a background to where the sooner we discover, confirm, validate, and acknowledge the real character of the moon, and by metonymy, of the rest of the solar system. That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow night. David Sarita has been doing some really amazing research into what I'm calling the designer solar system model, and he has some pretty astonishing developments to report. That's going to be tomorrow night. So tonight and tomorrow night are like bookends. What I'm praying, and really, it's not a metaphor, What I'm praying will happen is that this reality will dawn, will go viral, will spread around the world, and people will, as has happened in other conflicts, they will pause and look up and realize that what is happening on a much, much bigger stage. And this could be big enough to, as we have discussed in this program for many months now, to change the almost inevitability of a planet where, as you have increasing hot conflicts and wars and tit-for-tat retaliations, at some point, someone's going to make a very big, dumb, stupid mistake. And there is World War III. In a civilization which has mastered nuclear weapons, including tactical nukes, and there are forces that are calling verbally, vocally, for use of such technology, such weaponry, even now in the conflicts going on in Ukraine, in the conflicts going on in Gaza. And of course, tonight we're looking at Iran in an unprecedented major missile and drone attack on the territorial property of Israel, Israel itself. We are in extraordinarily dangerous territory, extraordinarily dangerous, and we need something bigger to take everybody's attention and put it where it belongs, which is, what is the relationship to events going on Earth tonight, to larger events going on beyond the Earth, in the solar system, and beyond? That's kind of what we're going to talk about tonight. Sorry, I have a real tickle in my throat, so I have to keep taking water. Otherwise, it will, you know, it's been very dry here, very dry, very early in the spring and very dry. So that's my number one item. Go in, you'll look, and you'll find the details. You'll find, you know, submissions from the Jerusalem Post. You'll find AP. You'll find video of this extraordinary attack. And again, the defense forces have been able to shoot down everything except one or two. And there's been some property damage on a military base, so we're told. And as I said, there's been one injury so far. And when dawn comes and they can do a bomb damage assessment, I'm sure we'll get updates from Israel as to how bad. But it's really bad because it's bad politically. It means that Iran is at the edge of doing something really dumb. And that will force Israel, of course, to respond by doing something even dumber. And at this point, you know, all bets would be off. Let me go to number two. For those of you who are new to the show, you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com. You want to look for our banner tonight for Saturday, December 13th, which is a really amazing close-up of the edge of the moon covering the sun, which we'll talk about in some detail later on. The title of tonight's show is The Appearance of Sudden Hyperdimensional Breakthroughs Kicked Off by the Eclipse. And we've got two to talk about tonight. One is really quite amazing. The other one is moving the entire conversation in terms of, is there really artificial technology on the moon or is there not? And is it of the scale and size and dimension of what we've been saying for many, many years? Because, of course, as you all know, because I think I reported this last week, it was back in March of 1996 that I held the first press conference of the Enterprise mission focusing on the ET structures on the moon, the glass structures, and, of course, putative dome. We'll get into all of that detail as we move through the morning because there is new news. Sorry about that. I'm having a really tough time with my throat tonight. So throat chakras, whatever, whatever. All right. Let me begin by bringing on our panel, because I think we want to have this discussion with the panel as opposed to me presenting individual materials. We have Andrew Curry with us, who is, of course, an artist professional. He works on movies, works on television, works on the Super Bowl. He even has designed extensive layouts of materials for us to look at tonight. Andrew is bringing his mind tonight because we have access to many of his former posters, and we will be presenting those in due course. We've got Ron Gerbron, who's going to be joining us shortly. He's on his way home. He's on his cell. He's in the middle of the night in, well, it's not middle. It's kind of just after sunset there in California, but it's dark, so he's using his cell phone as a flashlight, and when he gets home, he will join us. Ron, of course, is a uncredentialed polymath with a deep interest in archaeology, especially Martian archaeology, and we will be discussing some of the things that he thinks in terms of his not-quite-favorite subject, the moon, as we progress through the morning. We also have Robert Morningstar with us. Now, Robert is an interesting guy. He is a civilian intelligence analyst. He's certainly an investigative journalist. He's a psychotherapist. He lives in New York City. He's been specializing in photo interpretation and geometric analysis of space imaging for decades, graduate of the Power Memorial Academy and a New York State Region Scholar at Fordham University, where he received a degree in psychology. There's many other things you can read about folks in their bios attached down below on the other side of midnight. Just look for bios under the banner on the guest page, and then you can go and find them there. We've also got Ruggiero Kahlo joining us. Ruggiero is an Italian English descent from participating from native London. He is going to be showing us some sketches he's been making of some of the details of the last few days, particularly the new U.S. mission. And he'll be joining us, I believe, if not in the third. No, actually, I think he's going to be joining us earlier. So without further ado, let me bring on my panel and let me point everyone back to Radio with Pictures. I want you to all look at my item number 3. This is the U.S. eclipse photographed by Fernando Lano, who was an AP photographer. What Fernando decided to do, unlike most everybody else when they photograph eclipses, and I'm wondering whether he's been listening to our show, because that's the actual photo that he took. As you can see, it shows this very strange glowing ring. Sorry about that. Ring around the moon, which is a combination of the corona, 93 million miles away. But if you click on number 3 and then zoom in a photo program to look at the limb, at the edge of the moon, at the limb of the moon, you'll see a series of equidistant, brilliant dots, bluish dots, all around the limb of the moon. Equidistant bluish dots do not exist on the moon. That is the dome. That is the huge masses of materials left, probably supports, maybe structure, that's holding up the dome, which is about 20 miles high. It encompasses, get this, 300 million cubic miles of glass. Now, it's almost gone. It's incredibly old. It's almost gone. And were it not for the fact that there was so much of it at one time, after all these hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of years of erosion, it's been whittled away, whittled away, whittled away. So obviously, on the near side of the moon, because of the synchronized rotations and the orbit of the moon around the Earth, we only see the near side, the Earth side. Because of libration, we can kind of peek over the edges and maybe see something like 60%, not at the same time, but over about a month. But for all intents and purposes, the moon orbits the Earth with one side facing and the other side facing away. And the side facing away, the glass is very much denser than the side on the visible face of the moon that faces the Earth, where we have landed Apollo spacecraft, an unmanned spacecraft, successfully. However, in recent years, beginning about 4, 5, or 6 years ago when the Chinese started sending their missions, about 50% of all attempted landings on the moon have crashed, even though all those participants had the benefit of the NASA Apollo experience, the Russian experience, et cetera, et cetera. But it does not seem to have increased the odds. In fact, the odds have gone dramatically down. Why is that? Well, because they're trying to land in places like at the South Pole, where no human spacecraft in the modern era have landed. And that's where our measurements have shown that this ancient glass dome is much thicker, including on the far side, where it is even thicker than at the poles. And when you try to land a spacecraft on a planet with a glass-layered covering, even though it's incredibly eroded by micrometeorites, at some point you're going to encounter a large mass which has not been whittled away, and that will either be the end of your mission or your mission will be severely compromised, which, of course, in the last Japanese government mission launched by JAXA a few months ago called SLIM, it hit, apparently, a piece of the glass on the way down. It lost a rocket engine. Its thrust was unbalanced. It landed hard. It rolled and came to rest upside down. The newest American mission launched or landed on the 22nd of February. It was a little more successful, although it landed hard. It broke the landing struts. It tipped over at about a 30-degree angle, but it was sitting there and it gave the ground experimenters all their data. They were able to play back all the data recorded on the way down, and it's in that recorded data that we're seeing some astonishing corroborations, again, from the South Pole of the moon, close to, about 300 miles away, what the dome looks like at that very, very high, or in this case, low latitude, excuse me, within a few degrees of the lunar South Pole. Item number 4. This is where things get really, really, really dramatically interesting. Item number 4. That is a picture which should not exist. Look carefully. This is a picture of the shadow, about 150-mile wide shadow, the umbra of the moon shadow on the Earth, reflecting off the atmosphere, off the clouds, taken from the ISS International Space Station, the 260-mile high orbit of the space station. You can see some of the pieces of the station in the upper part of the frame. You can see this wonderful panorama, hundreds of miles wide view of the Earth, the curvature of the atmosphere, the eclipse shadow, and the interesting color effects in the clouds around the shadow. And here's where things get really, really dramatic. That picture that you're looking at, number 4, taken of the eclipse shadow from the space station just south of the Gulf of Mexico, looking north. In fact, you can see a little better if you go to number 5. This is a simultaneous comparison I created. The image on the right is the ISIS image taken from the space station of the eclipse cracking north across the Gulf of Mexico. And the image on the left is from GEOS West, which is one of the modern ultra-sophisticated synchronous satellites with very high-resolution cameras focusing down on the weather from 22,300 miles. And if you look at the detail of the eclipse in both pictures, you're going to see something that by every NASA model of the moon is impossible. Those pictures, number 5, left and right, we should not be seeing those. According to NASA and what the moon is, according to them, what we're looking at on the left image, the full disk, with the eclipse tracking up across the Gulf of Mexico, just about to come on shore at Texas. And the one on the right, which was shot, you know, within a minute or two, because you can see the same prominent cloud features on the right-hand side of both. That picture, those pictures, should not exist. So, at that point, leaving everybody kind of poised on the edge of a big mystery, let me bring on my panel, starting with Andrew. Andrew, when you look at that picture, can you see what's wrong with it? Why we should not be even seeing it? Why it's impossible in any known universe that we've been given, yet there it is, and therefore it's a major clue?
Are you talking about the right panel?
Well, both
of
them.
Five?
Both of them. Start with number five. Start with number four. All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Because number five, the right one is number four, just reduced somewhat. And I put them side by side. Why is that picture impossible? Impossible. And total proof of the existence of the ancient lunar glass dome.
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, you do, but you don't know you do. That's what I keep kicking myself, because there's a great line in Star Trek, City on the Edge of Forever. Remember where they're standing in front of the Guardian of Forever?
Yeah.
And then at one point, Spock looks at Kirk and looks at the unveiling of time in the Guardian, and he's holding his tricorder, and he says very resolutely, "I am a fool." And Kirk, of course, looks very shocked. What? I am a fool, Captain. Here history is passing at light speed, and I have a tricorder, and I have not recorded anything. Because they were trying to find where McCoy had gone back and changed time.
Yeah, yeah.
When I looked at this picture 2 days ago, that line from Spock, I thought to myself, how could I have been such an idiot? I've been looking at these pictures for decades. Decades, and I did not know what I was seeing, and I felt so stupid and idiotic. And then there was this, oh my God, it's the breakthrough. Again, Andrew, why is what we're seeing in that picture, number four, and the right side of number five, why is it impossible? And as an artist, you see, we're all in this, we cannot.
I know why.
Hang on, Robert. We cannot see what we can't imagine. So let Andrew finish your shot, and then we'll come to you.
All right.
Andrew?
I don't know, Richard. Yeah, no, I'm here. Listen,
okay.
Muted. No,
right.
I'm not.
So you're looking at it, but you're as dumb as I was. Okay. Robert, your turn. What do you think?
Well, there are two shadows across the United States. They're disparate. They're not circular as if it were one shadow of the moon.
Well, wait a minute. You're looking in number four. In number four, you're only 260 miles up. You're looking north. The shadow of the moon is vertical, a circle, but you're looking so far north from where the space station is, it's elliptical. It's foreshortened.
Yeah, right. I'm talking about the left side of the picture.
So now we're going down to number five.
Okay, the one that shows the Earth in total on the left side.
Yeah, that's number five, where I did a composite.
Okay.
Yeah, that's shot from 22,300 miles up, full disk. You're looking at almost exactly the same time as the photo from ISIS on the right. Again, why is this an impossible picture?
Well, like I said, the one on the left side in number five has two shadows, and they are split, and there's no circular shadow of the moon, which we would expect to be uniform.
You're looking at the shadow right dead center in the Gulf of Mexico. It's just very dark. There's no sunlight, so the camera can't record any light. There's no light, so it's a very dark.
The Gulf of Mexico picture, yes, the moon is circular or oval because of our perspective.
Slightly, because the angle to the vertical is about 50-some degrees, 60 degrees.
Yeah.
So it's almost vertical.
It is one mass. It is one mass consistent with a round shadow of the moon.
Yeah, right. Okay, here's the part, Andrew. We're going to go back to Andrew. The reason it's an impossible picture is because where is the color coming from? The brilliant reddish color, both in the
yeah, I was looking
in the space station view and in the, geosynchronous satellite view. Why is there this broad reddish area around the total eclipse, around the 150-mile-wide shadow?
Well, that was the one thing I was thinking, especially on number four when I'm, it's the larger image. And on the right side, there's this sort of pinkish,
It's more than sort of. It's obvious.
Yeah.
It's blatantly
very
obvious. And the reason you don't see it around most of the rest of the circle is because there aren't very many clouds there. If you look at the close-up of the clouds, the clouds that are visible are reddish in a ring around the total shadow of the total solar eclipse, the so-called umbra. Now,
that's the penumbra. That red glow and the clouds.
Right, exactly. But why is it colored red? That's what
because
hit me. Suddenly, it's like, no, it's impossible. It's colored red and it cannot be, but it is. And we're getting down to about 4 minutes to the bottom of the hour. So what I will do is, Ruggiero, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Okay, take a look at the picture. What do you think? Causing the red color around the shadow of the moon, which is, by the way, the shadow of the eclipse here occurred at about, noonish, a little before noon. So the sun is basically as high in the sky as it can get.
Yeah.
It's not near the horizon. The sun's rays falling past the moon are basically almost vertical, within, 20, 30 degrees of vertical. So why is the shadow around the total umbra, the eclipse part of the moon, why is it red?
Let me just work.
This is
backwards.
Not a trivial question, as you will see. It's an amazing question. And I keep thinking to myself, why didn't I ask it years ago? Because like everybody else, I saw something and I did not do the work myself. I assumed other people knew more than I did. And that's where we're going to have a very interesting conversation when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. And when we come back, I'm going to show you a stunning breakthrough in terms of simple observation. You don't need to know anything technical or scientific to figure this one out. You just need to realize it's a possibility. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We're talking about the eclipse, the U.S. eclipse, which crossed the United States on Monday afternoon and gave us a stunning new confirmation of the existence of a glass dome completely covering the moon. And we'll show you how when we return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night on the 13th of April. My birthday is next week sometime. We're talking tonight about the eclipse and how one new datum, a trivial, obvious observation that I wished I'd made, you know, years ago, decades ago, because it's so stupid that I didn't see it. I, again, feel like Spock. You know, I've been up to my guests, my panel, and we'll talk about why this is such a stunning breakthrough in the question, is there an ancient glass dome around the moon? Because, of course, if there is, then what it means is that the eclipse that everybody was musing about all week long, networks are running post-promos showing how they had, you know, correspondence in the field, live video of the eclipse, and of course video is nothing compared to seeing it for real, I guarantee you. One of the observers said the difference between seeing what most Americans saw, a partial eclipse with the moon shadow encroaching on the disk of the sun, through safety glasses, of course, what they saw compared to being in totality, someone said, some experts said, well, if a partial eclipse is like a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10, a total eclipse is a million. There is no comparison between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse. And I pray that most of you in the audience have an occasion to get on an airplane sometime and go see the next one anywhere in the world, because the next one here is not going to happen till 1944. And that's kind of a long time to wait. So, okay, back to my panelists. Everyone has a shot here. Has anyone realized what it is we're seeing and why it's such an astonishing confirmation of the ancient lunar dome? Andrew?
Richard O'Quill.
All right, Ruggiero?
Well, let Andrew go first, and then I'll
say something. Andrew, go ahead.
Well, I mean, obviously, you're kind of leading the witness here, Richard, but is it a refraction?
Yes!
Okay.
Imagine this. There's a group at MIT that are so concerned about global warming. They're talking about making a parasol to put it in one of the L5 or 4 or 3 positions to basically act like a giant parasol to blot out the sun.
Oh.
And they plan to make it out of asteroid material, lunar material, whatever. So it'll be a dense, you know, not probably one disk, but a whole bunch of them in very constrained orbits. That's their model, right? And what they will have is a passive occulting disk like the moon, right? That comes in front of the sun like the moon during an eclipse, and the sunlight streaming past it will be the color sunlight, because it's just a physical opaque disk like the moon is a physical opaque sphere, which is 2,000 miles wide, the size of this disk that the MIT guys are talking about. But instead of making a sphere and making it, you know, massive, they're going to make it as light as possible. So it's going to be a fibrous framework. It's going to be little panels, but it's going to be solid. It will not be made of glass. It will not be made of any transparent material. It will be made out of something opaque so that they can use it as a timed shadow, probably with louvers or some kind of electromechanical control, so they can allow the amount of light that comes through, kind of like a Venetian blind. Think of it as a huge Venetian blind that's 2,000 miles across, made out of God knows how many separate spacecraft, all station keeping and aligned so that they can control the shadow where it falls on the Earth, and they can reduce global warming that way. I mean, the idea itself is very controversial and has all kinds of upsides and downsides, and it's a whole program. I'm going to try to get the guys on sometime when we get closer to summer to talk about the details. The point is, though, that if you can imagine a thought experiment, a Einsteinian thought experiment, where you have either the current moon, as NASA's shown it, you know, a dusty, waterless, dry, cratered disk in the sky, 2,000 plus miles in diameter, moving between the Earth and the Sun, casting its shadow on the Earth, what in any of those components would create reddish clouds around the center of the eclipse, around the shadow itself? Nothing, right?
I disagree.
Go ahead.
The reason those clouds are turning pink, or I would say copper, is the same reason that the moon turns copper orange during a lunar eclipse. The umbra is dark and the penumbra is red light that is bent around either the Earth or around the moon. So I think that this is a consequence of the penumbra casting on the clouds.
Okay, anybody else have a reaction?
I don't yet at the moment, unfortunately, but I stick with your model.
Okay,
Richard.
Andrew.
Can I just finish?
Yeah,
because when you look at Alan Bean on his on one of his paintings, he paints the moon as a quite pinkish color when the spacecraft is orbiting at a sideways angle parallel to the moon. So it would carry good weight in your discussion that if that pinkish that we're seeing in all our enhanced pictures is there, then it's, as Andrew said, it's giving a very light pink haze refraction onto the surface of the Earth.
Well, onto the clouds, and then when you look at the at the Geos image, apparently there's this red ring around the ground is reflecting red light brilliantly back toward the moon. The Earth penumbra during a lunar eclipse has nothing to do with this. Geometrically, it's exactly the opposite, because the thing that's illuminating the Earth, the full disk, is, of course, the Sun, which is illuminating all of the Earth except for the circle represented by the shadow, because it's in full sunlight. So the refraction in the Earth's atmosphere is non-existent. This is not sunset where the light is coming in a tangent to the surface. It's coming almost vertically. It's only passing in NASA's model, a dead gray cratered landscape with no optical active elements. So there's no bending of light. There's no diffraction, no scattering. It's just sunlight streaming past the moon. But at the edge of the shadow, it's a reddish, really pinkish ring on the clouds. And when you look at the ATS image, I'm sorry, the Geos West image, you know, it's obviously red on the, it's so red, the landscape is kicking back selectively red illumination, which surrounds the shadow very symmetrically. So, Andrew, you mentioned, I think, the magic word, glass.
Yeah, refraction through glass. So, Richard, holding that thought for a moment, didn't we see something like this in Jezero Crater in that first image that was kind of at the legs of that of the lander in the landscape, like when the sun was really low and we saw a very similar type of casting of pinkish reds?
There are two problems. One is Jezero, you're under another much smaller dome. So you got the dome effects there. And then you're on a planet at sunset, so you've got refraction through the Martian atmosphere. No. Let's stick with the so-called airless moon.
Okay.
You know, this really does not involve Mars at all. Item number 6 explains what we're seeing, except I didn't change the scale. Obviously, the scale is all wrong. If there is a glass dome around the moon, tangent at the limb, it will appear from Earth like a glass ring around a dark center, like the lens is only 20 miles high or thick, but it completely circles the moon in this model, right?
Yes.
Okay. As the moon moves across the sun, particularly at noon, by definition, for the sun to be high in the sky across the United States, it had to be at noon. It's not entering anywhere near the horizon. The path length of atmosphere it's coming down through is basically no different than if it was shining vertically, even at the 15 or 20 degree angle. So what is causing the red? Well, that's number six. Because what it turns out is that the dome around the moon, which was never created to be a lens, is a chromatically aberrated lens. What does that mean? Chroma, meaning color in Latin. Aberration, meaning an anomaly, meaning distortion. When you buy telescopes, particularly when you're a kid, cheap telescopes do not have what are called color-corrected achromatic lenses, meaning they are composed of more than one simple lens, so that they have two parts of the lens which functions to counteract the misfocus of red and blue and violet light, which happens in a normal lens. And so you bring the focals back together, and so you have what's called an achromatic lens, meaning it's corrected the chromatic aberration of a simple lens. The ring of glass around the moon is not correcting for anything. It's just there. It's refracting the sunlight from 93 million miles further away from the sun. And so if you look at number six, look at where the rays, the blue, the green, the yellow, and the red on a normal non-corrected lens fall. They don't fall all in the same place. They don't all come to the same focus. And that's what we're seeing at almost high noon around the eclipse. And I looked at a whole bunch of other images. And when I knew what I was looking for, I found decades of observations of Earth satellites, NASA data, other space programs. They all show the same thing. Regardless of the angle of the eclipse to the local vertical, the shadow around the central umbra, the central deepest part of the eclipse, the center of the shadow of the moon, is colored because there's a lens around the moon called the dome. This is such a stunning development. And again, by any scientist, pick one at random in the phone book, run this geometry problem, and they will give you the same answer, because there's no other simple answer to what we're seeing. It's breathtaking that all these years I've looked at this, and I really feel like Spock. I feel dumb and stupid, because the answer to how do you prove that this is all real is right there in front of us. Now, how come no one else has figured this out? Because the transition, if you looked at any of the television of the eclipse, the transition from the final diamond ring, the sun shining, you know, through a big obstruction like a mountain, and totality occurs in seconds. And for people who are looking with glasses, their eyes are not dark adapted, because they're looking at the eclipse sun through the equivalent of welder's glasses. The effect happens so rapidly. No one that I know of, and I have to go looking, of course, has done very high speed photography like my friend Charlie, when they were developing films and cameras to photograph nuclear tests. They would run thousands or millions of frames per second. And if you wonder what a camera that can run a million frames per second, a film through it, looks like, you can just Google and you'll find it. It was called a Rapitronic, and it was actually developed for shooting scientific footage of nuclear tests. Well, nothing like that has been ever attempted, as far as I know, because no one has attached a very short time scale changing light from the moon eclipsing the sun as having any other interest other than optically, visually providing like Bailey's beads or the diamond ring, not realizing that if you ran a photometer with three different filters, red, green, and blue, and you recorded at the totality with the moment when the brilliant light of the photosphere disappears and the corona is occulted by the moon, if you do this rapid measuring exactly when totality occurs over and over and over again, with the sun high in the sky, the sun low in the sky, you will see this color shift, which only can take place because there's a glass dome around the moon. Now, what does this change? It changes everything because it means when we looked up at the moon on Monday, you were looking at a major element of what I call the designer solar system. So the fact that we have eclipses, the fact that we have this pageantry, the fact that we have all this physics laid out over and over and over again by somebody a very long time ago, and we've totally forgotten what it really means, is kind of, you know, our problem, because now we need to, with technology and spacecraft and multiple planetary missions, we need to go back, figure out the dimensions of the dome, what else it does, how else it affects us, and of course it changes everything because we are living not in a natural wonder, but in a designer solar system with lunar eclipses and solar eclipses made to order by whoever was here before us. Thoughts?
Hey, Richard.
Yeah.
I can confirm that this chromatic aberration model is correct because I beheld the face of the Gorgon and lived. In May of 1994, I went up, I flew to Saratoga, New York, where we were having an annular eclipse. And during the annular eclipse, I took my glasses off and I saw all of these rays. And the effect was that every body, every object, every leaf on the trees cast three or four shadows, red, green, blue, white, all of them. And it was very psychedelic. And it also made clouds appear in the sky that weren't visible when it was pre-eclipse and post-eclipse. So this is an effect of the glass structures of the moon. And with my naked eyes, I was able to see the mountains of the moon acting like prisms. And that was what was splitting the light into these prismatic spectra. So that is correct. The glass surface of the moon acts as a prism. And as a result, the penumbra of the moon is casting, filtering out everything except the red. The other colors are being filtered out by our atmosphere, which is what it does during the day. The atmosphere filters out all colors except
the blue. Well, I haven't figured out yet, but if you look at my number six, which is a kind of a schematic diagram, the blue and the other colors are coming to a focus, but either they're coming to a focus probably deep in the earth because of the geometry, because during the eclipse on Monday, we had about 4 minutes, meaning that the moon was relatively close to the earth, closer than normal. So the moon was bigger. So tracking across the sun in orbit at 2000 miles an hour, it took 2 minutes more than 2017. If you waited to where the shadow just comes to a focus above the planet, above the surface of the earth, and you can, you know, look at the calculations and see which ones are those. I imagine photographs taken with the right camera and the right speed at those moments will show an astonishing view of an eclipse that we've never seen with the naked eye and not with photography, because photographers don't know there's something there besides a shadow to photograph. This is such a breakthrough, because we've got about two eclipses every year somewhere around the earth, give or take. Sometimes it's longer, sometimes shorter. At the next eclipse, this experiment to specifically measure the refraction of the shadow of the ring lens around the moon should be a very high priority, because the results will be obvious and dramatic and easy, and the content will be very revelatory in terms of the physics of the dome and the scale and what kind of glass. Remember, the biggest mystery I have so far is what kind of glass did they use? Or did they make a special glass? Did they add metals and ions? And in other words, was the dome a multi-purpose, incredible architectural structure built by a super ET civilization? You don't dome in a planet if you don't really know how to dome in a planet. And we can't, so they're much more advanced than we are. And we might be able someday to do something similar, but it would be incredibly super, super expensive. And of course, there's no reason for us to do anything like this unlike those who rearranged and redesigned and remodeled the solar system so we could see it and experience it. And I think there are deeper level messages that we're supposed to be apprehending when we see this every total eclipse, and we have forgotten totally those lessons were supposed to be. Andrew?
Yeah, Richard, I'd like to add to it. So red in the color spectrum is the longest wavelength. And, you know, just thinking back to our, well, you can look at any prism, but thinking back to our, you know, color wheel when we were kids and learning about colors, red is the most dominant. And so, that, I mean, it, that by your model, red, pinkish, you know, what the colors that we're seeing is in that part of the spectrum, and that's what we see the best, and that's what appears. So it kind of holds true. I don't know if that makes sense, but I just know that red is the most dominant within the prism when you break down white light.
Which is what you're seeing in items 4 and 5.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I keep so kicking myself because I've been on this trail, as you know, since 1996. If right. I'd realized that every total eclipse right around it, there's the evidence. Because with an airless surface, you can't get the color around the moon. There's no way.
So just to be a bit of a contrarian for Ron's sake, because I know he was here and then he disappeared and he hasn't come back. And I know we're about 8-7 minutes out from the top of the hour. But one of the sort of – and other people that, again, Richard, that some of the people that kind of chirp into me during the show is like they're a bit
incredulous about
it, right?
You mean they chirp as opposed to tweet?
Hey, there you go. I'm going to make my own social media site. No.
We'll call it Chirper.
Well, Ron says, you know, like he kind of said to me the other day, and I think I remember him saying this in the past, is I hope he didn't trip into, you know, a field somewhere and disappear on us into a – well, I guess we'll find him. But he said, you know, I can buy that these domes are over specific craters – there might be structures left over that, but why? And this goes back to the question that Nova talked about is why a dome? And again, I think, you know, people have this idea that it's a big glass bowl, whereas you've talked about it more like a, was it a sea anemone? No. How did you describe it? It's some sort of sea creature that has like spikes coming out.
A sea urchin, a spiny sea urchin. Yeah. With all kinds of things sticking out. When it was
right.
New, yeah. No, right. I don't think it was a smooth glass. I think it had incredible towers, and we see evidence
right.
again in some of the Apollo imagery of them almost destroyed because of erosion. You know, people have no idea of scale. If you take something with the density of cigarette smoke and you, instead of, you know, seeing it across a room where you can see cigarette smoke in a smoke-filled room, if you're
right.
dealing with politics, you know, back cliche, whatever. Imagine a smoke-filled room that goes on for 1,000 miles.
Yeah,
in other
well,
words,
yeah.
even if something is very, very, very thin, if you have enough of it over enough miles of what we call optical path length, even the invisible becomes visible. You just need to add mass. So add another 10,000 miles. In other words, It's the linear proportions of the moon, the staggering scale of the moon that makes it possible for us to see this stuff, even if it's now incredibly degraded and eroded. And how do we know it's degraded and eroded? Because our guys landed and took off successfully many, many times from the lunar surface on the side of the moon facing us. And that's where you can see the erosion is most severe. That's why the problems with the missions going to the poles are like 50% die. Well, they don't do it because we don't know how to make spacecraft. They don't do it because we don't know the lessons of NASA landing on the moon. They don't succeed because they hit something. Either they really don't know this is there, which I keep finding amazingly, you know, I'm flabbergasted. Or only a few know, and they're not sharing it with others. For some reason. I mean, this is not a simple geopolitical problem because, of course, we are now in a war kind of at the edge with China about who's going to control the moon. And the other night there was a piece from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has now announced that it's going to, in fact, it already has let contracts out to like 10 or 12 of the leading corporations, technological corporations in the U.S., and they're looking at how to design and build a lunar railway. Well, remember 2001? Remember that great scene, Andrew, where you've got the guys going over the charts of TMA-1, the Tycho Magnetic Anomaly 1, and they're in a moon bus, and they're on a ballistic trajectory from wherever they started to Tycho to land and look at this thing close up? That, according to DARPA, is not the way we're going to get around the moon. They want to build a lunar network railway covering all key points you might want to visit or explore or research or live or build a base at on the moon. Why are they going, Andrew, for a railway as opposed to flying in a moon car where you have infinite refueling from the fuel resources on the moon itself?
Because it's on the lunar surface where you're not going to hit the glass.
Exactly. You don't dare send helicopter, you know, rocket rides around the moon because at some point you're going to hit the glass. You cannot map. There's so much. And where you want to go is places where maybe the ancients were. And in other words, the DARPA non-answer of building a railway as opposed to developing in situ rocket rides anywhere you want, which on an airless moon, the NASA moon, would be perfectly safe. You know, you're as safe riding a rocket as you are riding a helicopter, in fact, safer, because with rockets, you've got multiple engines. And with helicopters, you've got only two blades. And if you lose one, you're dead. So the idea of opting for a railway as opposed to point-to-point transport through a non-existent dome, it's obvious to me they know what's there. They know what they're dealing with. And the current unmanned mission, the Odysseus mission, remember, it carried five experiments from NASA. Do you remember what those experiments were, guys? Radios covering different wavelengths, different frequencies, different bandwidths. Why are they doing that? Because obviously if the glass is thicker over the South Pole and that's where you want to put your base, because that's where the volatiles are, if the dome is too thick, it will interfere with radio transmissions. And there go your computer links, your communications, your video calls, your phone calls, your monitoring and management of a lunar base from Earth, et cetera. In other words, unless you can communicate through the dome, you're dead in the water. So what did the first mission to land in 52 years do? They literally sent radio receivers to the surface of the moon so they can find out if the dome is transmissible to key radio frequencies. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device.
search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight for this Saturday, the 13th of April, 2024. Slightly under a week since this astonishing eclipse that went from Texas all the way to New Brunswick, leaving, Upper Maine and providing stunning video. But again, unless you see one live with your own eyes, and its totality, you have not seen anything. And now you can carry a little pocket experiment anywhere in the world and look at a total eclipse, and you can prove by the colors recorded at the moment of totality going in and coming out, you can prove for anyone there's an ancient glass dome looking like a ring lens around the moon. Okay, I want to come back now, and I think, Ruggiero, it's time to give you some really decent quality time, because you have arrayed a series of rather astonishing things. So let's go to your items. Let me change something here. Okay. First of all, Ruggiero is an actual doctor. He's a podiatrist. He works on people and bones. And you were going to say something?
In the UK, we're not doctors, but we do in our podiatric medicine degrees.
I was going to say, if I break my foot, I want you and nobody else. Okay, so.
Well, thank
anyway,
you.
But Ruggiero has an amazing eye for detail, and so. Beginning with the Martian femur, which is a bone found by the Curiosity rover on Mars many, many, many years ago and not admitted, of course, by NASA. He has become... Say again?
What, you heard that?
I heard
we
that.
We can hear you, Ron.
Yes, we heard you, Ron. Oh. Hang on.
Okay, well, Keith kept saying that I wasn't there. I think you might have had me muted on your board or something.
Nope. Anyway, so let me go back to Ruggiero, and then we'll come back to you. So, Ruggiero, you have been assembling details on the moon, comparing the Bean imagery, the Bean paintings, comparing the new missions, and you've come to some very interesting conclusions. So, go ahead.
Well, but what I've tried to lay out today is a little composition of the history of what we've been seeing over the last coming months that's arising to us, and one new discovery, which I will talk about a little bit later. And I wanted to present through your image, I think it's number 7 or 8, and I've put it on as my number 1. Where we got this fascinating, I was just captivated by these colours that you brought out. I first looked at it, I was like, what on earth is that? I couldn't make out.
Well,
for
people that aren't on the web, let me describe what you're talking about. I put together a composite of a left-hand 180-degree fisheye lens image of the Odysseus spacecraft carrying the International Lunar Observatory Association camera down to the surface of the moon. And after the landing, even if it was shaky and much harder than they wanted, and the gun, you know, in terms of details, the glass was responsible for that. We can talk about, you know, how that works if anybody's interested. But they did manage to get down. They did manage to not crash. They managed to keep the radios going. And then they downloaded all of the imagery that they took from lunar orbit down to the surface, down to the experimenters on the ground. And the International Lunar Observatory Association folks, they published on their website, which is available there on the other side of midnight, details of some of these images that were photographed as they were moving to the surface of the moon from orbit. And the one on the number six, is it number six? Hang on, let me go look, make sure I don't want to get the wrong one. No, it's number seven. The left-hand image is the wide angle. The right image is the corrected view of the lunar dome shot from midway through it as they were touching down. And number eight is a much larger version with the highest resolution. And what you see, I see, is a stunning series of geometric architectural details that appear to be pretty good shape, not much eroded. They're on the underside of the dome over the south pole of the moon. There's incredible detail, architecture, geometry, colors, organization. It looks 3D. It looks like it's not one plane, but it's different objects, different geometries at different distances. And that's all in 7 and 8. And what you've done, Ruggiero, is to come off that and give us closer and more detailed analyses in your picture, which I think we're going to go is number, what number are we going to in your section? Number one?
Number one is your image, but let's talk through each little section. So,
okay.
Firstly, I was captivated by the beautiful array of coloration, firstly. And then when we zoom in on the picture, we'll see exceptionally geometric patterning and featuring, and in agreement with you, very 3D in its appearance, working through the photo frame. So if we go on to, I want to click on to number two. What I did, I followed Alan Beaton's work, as I know much of the team.
So we're in Ruggiero's section of radio pictures. We're looking at number two,
which is an Alan Bean painting.
Yep.
And I screenshotted this from, he's got two websites. Obviously, he's not with us anymore. His family and his supporters have got two websites detailing all his work. And when you click him on the background, around Bean, you will see he's got the lower section of the sky is black, the moon sky, and the upper section starts to be a geometric blue. And he's put this in quite a few of his paintings, blue, purples. They're the same colors that we are seeing in real life later imaging. And I think that this piece of evidence that Bean has been trying to get across as an artist in his pictures is now supported by photos we're seeing, when you just up the contrast slightly, in the new missions. So it's really important. We study Bean's work, plus on his suit, you can see those color refractions on the left-hand side of his spacesuit. And if you go to the original image, it's all over, including on his lip.
Well, hang on. Let me stop you there, because the classic, you know, guys in spacesuit on the moon, the classic portrayal would be his sun side would be incredibly bright because it's in full sunlight. His shadow side should be completely black because it's not seeing sunlight. And yet in Bean's painting, he shows this absolutely array of colors that in my model are coming from the sun refracting through the dome, both from the sun side and from the shadowed side, because of course the light is being scattered by the glass remaining overhead. And all it takes is for one angle to be just right for you to be sprayed with a whole bunch of color, even if your shadowed side is not seeing directly sunlight.
Yeah. Now the important thing about looking at Bean's paintings, because he is the only astronaut who's detailed what we're seeing from that I know of. So the massively important feature that we're observing here is the colors on his spacesuit are just about exactly the same as the colors we're bringing out when we do our very slight enhancement. And they match exactly. So I think, you know, we'll come back to that point. So I'll go on to, let's have a look. Let's pop on to number three. What does everybody see? My number three.
Got it.
Let's talk through it. So what do you see, Richard?
Well, I see geometry. I know it says circuit board screenshot. But see, we only look at circuit boards in a certain way because we know what they do. If we encountered this geometry in any other context, we wouldn't know what it was used for. I don't think on the scale of the dome, we're looking at something we would call circuitry for two reasons. One is the size, and the other is that we're looking, even if you look at your number one, okay, let's go back to number one, which is my number, I think, eight, okay? All that detail is being seen through glass. So you're looking at layers and layers and layers. And I know from other work that we've done over the years that the glass is arrayed in vertical columns, like it was glass pillars, like supports, like ribbing. And so you've got cylindrical lenses against background, against more cylindrical vertical pipe lenses, against more back. In other words, you're looking at a multiple image with multiple image planes. So what you're seeing is the result of everything in your optical path between the structure, the architecture, the glass, and the camera. And we don't know how much stuff there is in between. So the fact that it looks really weird and circuity, I think is a side effect of the architecture and the scale and the glass in between. I do not think we're looking at circuit board technology in the lunar sky.
I did a few sketches. I think what's more important when this is looking at the screenshots, but we're going to look at the sketches anymore. So if we could click on my number four. That's my, it's kind of like an artist impression. I just measured it with a ruler.
It looks like an architect's blueprint, a very rough sketch blueprint of somebody's dream house somewhere.
All I've done is I took my number three and I sketched the central section. And if you look on number three, really let your eyes relax.
Oh, I can see it. I see it. As soon as you lay it out, remember, what you can't see, you can't imagine, and vice versa. But once we have a kind of a field guide, you know, your perception, it's obvious what's there.
Yeah, so I obviously, for simple purposes, I named it circuit board because that's what it initially looks like. But then as I softened my eyes, I'm seeing layers within layers, and I can kind of see what I perceive as 3D, but I'm not sure, but it looks like lots of kind of internal buttressing coupled with
I'm much more in love with number five.
Pancaking.
I'm definitely in love with number five, okay?
Let's have a look. I need to so number five, I did a sketching on number six. If we go to the central feature, have you zoomed right in?
I'm looking at five and six. Okay, I'm looking at six. All right.
We're on six. I'm on five. So let's stick on five. We can see almost like a train tracking central bit. So you've got about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 black dots through the middle. You want those?
Yeah, there's all kinds of symmetry.
There's all right. So we're going to pause, and then we'll go to the left. Do you remember that Bennu image where I said, it looks like a chromosome?
Are you comparing an image we're not seeing, Bennu?
I'll come back to that. But if you look to the left, there's like a circle with two finger fork projections sticking out.
Yep, I see it. It's basically toward the left of the bright area.
Yeah. And if you add these two fingers to the right,
it's got like a tuning fork sticking out to the left.
That's the one. Immediately go back to the middle.
Okay.
And go on to the right, and you'll see this hexagony looking structure.
I see it. Yep.
Right. So then
this must be maddening to radio people who can't see this.
I know. Then go on to my image number 6.
Okay.
And I've drawn this reoccurring shape, which we're seeing in this.
Oh, okay.
In the geometry. And that looks like that little bit to the right.
Well, what you're showing is organization. You know, geometry. None of this should be on the moon. Remember, I had nothing to do with taking these pictures. These are pictures taken by two separate corporations that I've never talked to directly. I've tried, but they won't respond. So it's not our cameras. It's not our intent. It's what is on their pictures, and all we've done is to publish them.
Yeah. So jumping the gun slightly, if we pop onto image 10.
Number 10. Scrolling down to 10. Okay, now we're on the Bennu fragments.
We are.
Yeah, I would not make too much. Ruggiero, I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
Can I just show you one thing?
Because, look, geometry, unless you know the scale, you have no idea what it might be used for. In the Bennu fragments, we're looking at very tiny things that look like circuits, right?
Yes, that's
my 11 and 12. They could be circuits. But in terms of the dome, other than the artist's projection in your mind of this looks similar, I don't think the use is at all similar. I think the architecture in the dome is huge by comparison. The reason that it kind of looks like circuits is because there's only certain ways you can make circuits, put them together, and they'll all look kind of familiar because form follows function. But architecture on the scale of what we're seeing above the moon, that's living space, that's factories, that's communications, that's... We have no idea what this stuff is used for. We just know it shouldn't be there.
Well, that's why I detailed number 6, because it's a reoccurring pattern that was both visible on the little Bennu sections, and it's throughout this this amazing, amazing picture that we're seeing here. We've got the IO stuff, which I wanted to touch on later.
Yeah, well, let's hold off on IO, because that takes us so far in place beyond Jupiter. Well, gentlemen, okay. Andrew.
There we go. Thank you.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I know what Ruggiero's getting at here. And again, I know you, well, actually you didn't make a comparison, but you and I talked about it, is that this design that we seem to be seeing in the skyscape, it reminds me of Kirby art, like this sort of very repeating pattern. It's almost Mesoamerican. Ron might be able to relate to that, but it's
that's right.
That's what it looks like to me now. And I think you're right, Richard. I think we're looking through layers. I think that's, maybe there might be some lining up and stuff, but that's what it reminds me of is again, coming back to an artist who may have been in the know on some way or another. It's Kirby-esque to me. And what I mean by that is his like The Eternals, his comic book series, The Eternals, and like where there's lots of these plants. Well, it's the stuff we've been seeing in the Marvel Universe, right? That's what it reminds me of. It's intelligent. It's organized. I mean,
once you say that, everything changes.
Yeah.
The moon, everybody was awestruck by on Monday, is not a natural phenomenon. Somebody designed this for us, and we've forgotten, A, who they were, B, where they lived, C, our relationship, D, when they did all this. In other words, we knew almost nothing. And for most people looking at the eclipse, they still know almost nothing because they did not get deeper than, oh my God, look at that. And that's what science is supposed to do. And so now we've got a really solid foundation for the idea that eclipses, total solar eclipses. I was amused by some wag was saying, well, in another 620 million years, we won't see this anymore. Really? And he didn't realize what he was saying. Because what he was saying was the coincidence between human beings living on Earth, right, and this stunning spectacle overhead, and the coincidence in time that humans live during a time when you can see this, because it will go away. Gravity and tides and the motion of the sun and the Earth and the moon and the solar system, the moon is moving away. There is a point in time, 620 million years was the number the guy gave, when we will no longer have a total solar eclipse. So we've got this window. And nowhere in anybody's discussion did anybody bring up the idea, well, isn't it kind of weird that we happen to be living when we can see this? Because obviously the next conclusion is, well, maybe it's not a coincidence. Maybe it's because we're the reason we are here. We are the ones who we have been waiting for. We just need to get back in touch with who we really are. And don't everybody speak at once.
Well, that was Ron's introduction there. He was rolling out his carpet for himself.
Oh, you heard something for a change. No, I've been... Every time I try and participate, I'm just not there. So
well,
I just figured,
well,
okay,
now,
this is torment.
Well, now you are. Now you are. So.
Okay, let's try pushing this button one more time. I was waiting for you to go back to talking about the Lunarville trolley.
You can do that.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Bye-bye.
See? Now you can't hear me again.
Yes, we can. Ron?
I keep trying.
That's weird. Why can we hear him and he can't hear us?
Told you my phone was sick. Can't hear me again.
Yes, we can.
Can hear you, Ron.
Can hear me now.
We can
now
hear
you. Now you can because I'm on the speakerphone. I hate using the speakerphone, but okay. All right. Because then it's noisy because you can hear everything in the room. Well, what do you want? You're making a declaration that such and such is so. I don't know what to say. Why are we the chosen ones?
That's a really good question. Every religion forever has that tried to answer that question. Maybe it's time.
And they've all claimed that they were.
And maybe it's time we open another door in another library and looked at this from a totally different angle, because the physical evidence shows us we live in a designer solar system. So then the question is, who did it? Why are we here? Are we part of the experiment? Are we the focus of the experiment, which I kind of think we are? And how are we doing? And looking at what's going on in the Mideast tonight, we're not doing well at all.
Well, okay, well, putting aside the Middle East for the moment, this is ridiculous. I need to have it so I can put the phone where the reception is better. So can you hear me now?
Yes, yes.
You can hear me.
Okay, yes,
I just can't hear you. Okay, well, I'll deal with that. Maybe if I turn the other thing off. Okay.
This is called
now. Let's see if everybody can hear everybody. I don't know why the phone's well, aside from the fact that it's all busted up, I don't know why the phone's behaving this way. But no, I mean, are we not a bunch of Jehovah's Witnesses at the end of the 19th century waiting on a hilltop for the rapture or something like that?
Some are, yes.
And
those were Baptists.
I'm very sorry. Yeah, I know. I knew I got the denomination wrong, but somebody was. Yeah, that's happened numerous times. I studied them for a while, but that's happened so many times that I gave up trying to catalog them. But I don't know why this isn't just another example of that, because I don't see any particular effort on the part of the establishment to make this stuff happen. They seem to just be avoiding it.
Well, if you don't count DARPA, who just announced multi-billion dollar contracts extending over 10 years to build a railway all over the moon. I go back to the same question, Andrew, that I asked you over and over again. Why do you create a lunar economy when there's nothing there anybody wants?
Why would we create it?
How would you create a lunar economy and build at the expense of billions, hundreds of billions, an infrastructure to support a lunar economy, because railways are very capital intensive? Why would you even consider doing that when if you land at any particular spot on the moon, it's kind of like any other particular spot. You sample the radiation, you sample the soil, you look at the craters, take a few photographs and come home. Why is there this sudden huge push about the moon? Unless the moon contains something incredibly vital to humanity, and the war is now between a free society trying to somehow deal with it and a totalitarian society, i.e. China, trying to deal with it and keep the free society from intervening, and that sets us up for another confrontation with nuclear or even more extraordinary, depending upon what we learn up there, weaponry. How do we break the cycle?
This is relevant because it keeps somehow getting pushed aside. Very simply, if you build a railroad, and I'm sorry, I love railroads, and as I have dubbed it, the Lunarville Trolley, people should figure out that reference. You have to physically build it. We do not have Autobots that can go do this for us, and we are a bit away from building such things or designing them. So how do you do this, and how long does it take? And obviously you cannot use a railroad until you have rails going from one end to the other of the planned route. And California is a perfect example of that, where they scheduled and fought for and gathered together $60 billion to build this railway, this high-speed railway from Los Angeles to San Francisco, which everybody said, well, that'd be cool, you know, less air pollution from the planes, and, you know, trains are nice and it's quick and stuff. Why not? And so they put all that money aside. They are now $110 billion in the hole, and they've built like 6 miles of track, and it's all in the wine district, and it's not a high-speed rail. And they've taken that out of the design, even though that was what people signed for. Well, without much trouble building a simple railway here.
Okay, hang on.
How are you going to do it on the moon? I just want to know how long it's going to take.
We will talk about that in the next segment, because we are at the bottom of the hour. My guests this morning are Ron Gerbron, Andrew Curry, Robert Morningstar, Ruggiero Kahlo, and there could be some drop-ins. You're on the other side of midnight. We're discussing, in wake of the eclipse, the idea that we've got another data point that there is an ancient glass dome around the moon, notwithstanding the question why, which is kind of fun to think about. Ron's question, how much money will it take to create a railway network all over the moon? Because remember, with a railway network, you can't decide to change your mind later. You only can put the railway where you want the railway to go, meaning something is important about the railway. Again, you're on the other side of midnight. We shall return.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night. About 1.5 hour left to go before the witching hour here in the land of enchantment, with a beautiful post-eclipse crescent moon setting grandly over Bernalillo here in northern Mexico. My guest this morning is Ron and Andrew and Robert, and I think he's just gone to bed. He's got an early morning call, so I think he has left us. So, Andrew, Ron is right. Building railroads is a big effing deal, a huge deal. I love railroads, you know. That's one of the things that Rob and I didn't get to do, is to travel the Canadian Rockies on a, you know, overnight, you know, coast-to-coast kind of sleeper thing. We did in Britain, but we didn't here, because railways are built through the most amazing territory. But the recitation of the problems of the Transcontinental Railway during the Civil War, when Lincoln authorized an intercontinental communications and transportation system, railways are very expensive and very labor and or resource intensive. And I think a lot will be done by robots, because it's only going to take them like 10 years to begin to get this thing together. But they're talking about it now. But there's got to be a reason, Andrew. How can you build a railway if you don't know where it's supposed to go? And how do you know where it's supposed to go if all the moon is the same, unless you have a secret map and you know the places you should connect? Thoughts?
Well, let me add one thing to that. I know Greg Ahrens, who's been on the show before and friend of the show and one of our compatriots and researchers, he did mention, Richard, that DARPA was saying, well, the reason why we want to use trains, I believe it was DARPA, is to keep the dust down, because everything, if you're in little cars everywhere, although there is a car, like a moon buggy thingy car thing, going to be thingy.
Is that a technical term?
Sort of car. Yeah. Well, I'm sure that's some of the terms that were used by some of these people sometimes. But no, there is some sort of contract for that too. But it's a good point. I mean, there is a lot of dust. But that's sort of a, you know.
Well, wait. The way you get rid of the dust is you build airports or spaceports.
Right.
You basically make them out of lunar concrete. There's all kinds of simulants that have been done in laboratories. You know, we know how to use the regolith to make. Basically, you want a surface that will not blow dust into delicate things. So you simply pour concrete. Now, does that require a human being? No. I bet you can develop an AI concrete, you know, road surfacer like the big machines we see on interstates. And you can do all this by remote control, so that when you land your rocket, you have a couple acre flat piece of concrete, like a table, like a flat, you know, support to land on. So no, the dust thing is, I mean, Ron is right. Developing a lunar railway system to reach all the places that you want to explore, exploit. What's there to exploit? You know, in terms of the moon as a refueling base. You build one base at the South Pole. There's enough water down there to last for centuries, even at extraordinary rates. So that's not a problem. You don't need to build a planetary railway to go and get fuel. You know, you sample the lunar environment at a place. You do sortie missions. You run a little robot scout rocket. But no, they're building because they can't fly over the moon the way they'd planned. By the same token, they can't do any observatories on the moon. They can't do astronomy. Look at all that crud. You can't do a, 10-day long exposure of Betelgeuse from the surface of the moon to get faint details of the dust, because it's going to be popping out behind all the damn stuff in the sky every 30 seconds, if not shorter. So everything we have planned about the moon, because of the existence of this ancient alien mega architecture, must be recalibrated, repurposed, replanned, refinanced, and they've come up with a railway, which I think is incredibly revealing of stuff they don't want to tell us about yet.
Well, and it's funny, we do have a pop culture comparison to this idea.
Okay.
And it was John Carpenter's 2001 film, Ghosts of Mars, just sort of this weird...
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a train that connected all these settlements on Mars. And the main thing it revolved around were mining operations. Yeah. And it was mining operations.
No, you said the magic word, Andrew, it's settlements. That's
yes.
My point.
Yeah.
You don't just lay them out and then think of stuff to do with them. You can do that. That never even works well for highways. If you have a dome here and a dome there with people underneath it, okay, makes perfect sense.
But hang on, guys, hang on. If in the current NASA model of the moon, what do we got? We got a planet that's almost a planet, not quite, airless. It's domeless. It has basically no color. It's got tens of thousands of craters. No magnetic field. We don't know where all the good stuff is because doing the remote sensing, there are areas that appear to have slightly different chemical compositions or materials or elements like thorium or whatever, but not really. Like any piece of the moon can capture the solar wind and you can extract helium-3 or helium-4 from any cubic meter of the moon. You don't need to go to a specific place. So on Earth, Ron again is right. Railways basically follow settlement patterns. They're mega infrastructure investments in big architecture, big transportation sector, because you know where the valuable stuff is, because that's where you put your city or your village or whatever. On the moon, for some reason, before we've got one person living there more than, 3 days, i.e. Apollo, DARPA is mapping out a lunar transportation railway network, which is incredibly hundreds of billions of dollars economically and labor intensive. And we don't know where any of the good stuff that we want to get to is yet. What's wrong with this picture?
Right. Slight addendum too. You're talking about technology we don't have yet. So what they're asking for
in terms of AI robots building railways, we're so close. I would say that given the fact that this was a 10-year contract and they're talking about, Artemis 3 not till 2026, it's 2024, yep. That's 2 years. Give it another couple of years, give it 5 years, we'll have AI robots capable of building anything almost anywhere. So that's not my problem. My problem is locking up the resources in a network where you don't even know where the nodes should be, where the settlement should be, where the city should be. You only need one at the South Pole where the water is, and maybe one at the North Pole where there's more water. But the idea of a planet-wide network of railway, that sounds to me, Andrew, like somebody knows exactly how much money they're going to make, countless trillions. And they're costing out the investments in order to basically rake off the claims.
Richard, there's a legal hurdle that nobody is talking about.
Well, you're going to.
Well, I'm going to. Because it's important.
Yes, of course.
In 2011, I met with the UN Ambassador for Outer Space, Maslan Othman.
Oh, congratulations.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, and a high-ranking member of the State Department in charge of technological issues. And one of the topics we discussed was the UN Convention on Non-Exploitation of the Moon. There's a UN treaty.
Yeah, this was the 1967 treaty.
Right. No one owns the moon and no one is allowed to mine the moon. So unless these guys are going pirate, like the Chinese, you know, like yep. and ignoring it all, I really wonder. Or has there been a change? I haven't heard of any change in that treaty and that agreement that no one can claim the moon, no one can colonize the moon. But it seems like some people are going rogue, like China, the United States.
Wait. I thought this only applied to nation states that conspicuously absent in the treaty. And I must admit, it's been a lot of years since I read it. Is missing is corporations, mom and pop stores, Elon Musk, that kind of thing. And that's the big hole, because nobody imagined back in 67 that we'd be talking within our lifetime, you know, literally living on the moon and mining it. And mining is a very interesting term, because what happens if you don't mine, but you're basically salvaging?
Well, that's a good word, because
completely
salvage to be done. When we get to my items, I'm going to reveal some very interesting things. But Ruggiero says he has to leave, and I want him to hear what I'm going to say.
I don't have to leave.
Oh, I thought you said
no. That was Keith Morgan.
Keith Morgan
has a big date at Howard tomorrow, so he has to get up to crack of dawn.
Oh, okay.
We're flying on autopilot tonight.
Oh, okay.
I am flying the plane. Be very afraid.
Yep. Very good. What I wanted to say is, since I thought Ruggiero had to leave, I'll say it anyway, with regard to the Alan Bean photograph, over the last couple of weeks, I've been the beneficiary of a tremendous amount of color photographs leaked by NASA. And I can tell you that what is seen in the screen, in the face mask of the Apollo astronaut painted by Alan Bean, in the middle above the astronaut that is reflected, that is not refracted light. That's actually a mechanical object in suspension above the moon.
Yeah, right.
And it's very clearly depicted in some of these photographs that I'm going to be releasing over the next couple of weeks. And when we get to my items, I have some very exciting news about Buzz Aldrin having leaked a photograph about a month and a half ago that I found on his Twitter page. It was an autographed photograph of a cavern on the moon with a tremendous amount of debris. And the debris
Why do we go to your items right now? Because we've got a good solid 15 minutes here, and then we can pick it up on the other side.
That'll do. Okay, I only put three items there. First one, I'd like to announce that this movie will be coming out, Cosmic Betrayal, a film that I made with Sibella Clare.
Oh, Sibella!
Dear Sibella. So she and I have collaborated on several films now. You saw UFOs, the CIA, and the assassination of JFK. But we did another one, which is called Cosmic Betrayal, and it's been released in Europe and in Canada, and it keeps winning prizes. And most recently, it won the Grand Prix of Italy in Venice in an Italian film festival there. And it will be released here later this year, and I encourage you to...
Now, by the way, for folks wondering what that noise is, Robert is fending off a demented dentist with a dentist drill, and he's doing very successfully. So,
yes. So anyway, here, that's point number one. Cosmic Betrayal deals with the politics around the assassination.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. Sibella is a really good producer. She's an exquisite producer.
Yeah, she won the film prize at the Ciné Paris Film Festival.
Yeah, I'm in a couple of her earlier films.
Right. You're in the Antarctica film. Very good film. So secondly, this is, if you click that link, astronaut Apollo 11 astronaut leaks photo of lunar crash debris field. You'll see my enhancements of the photo that he released.
Well, at
now,
the moment, I am seeing... Okay, so I got to go to Substack. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
So what I worked on was a photo of a photo that he released with his autograph, which is, drew my attention. Why is Buzz Aldrin releasing a photograph and his autograph? And then when I began to study it, I started to find the debris field. And I can say now that having tracked down the original, it's even more amazing than what I was able to draw out. Mechanical parts, things that look like wheels that are shaped like Stonehenge, 12 segments in a circle, manifold covers. One fellow who read the article said, motorcycle crash in the desert there, right? So more of this will be coming out. And the third element is this very important document that was forced out of the German government that admits that there was no pandemic. It was a lie to begin with, the death jab. That in Germany, the people who died were age 83 and 82. The hospitals were not overloaded. And that the flu disappeared.
So wait, you say this is an official government report from the German government?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
It was forced out. It was forced out of the government by a freedom of information.
Why do we have a BitChute video? Why don't we have a source to the document itself then?
Well, you have it. You have the man reading it. The guy, the lawyer.
Oh, no. I want to read it myself. I don't want to hear anybody else interpreting.
Well, you can read it. You can watch it. You can search it yourself.
Can you find it on the web? If you can find a direct link,
it can be found on the web.
I would recommend someone, Robert probably, get back in touch with Keith, and after the show we post the actual link to the document.
Yeah, he gives a very good synopsis, but basically this is official government secret that they
were.
Well,
I like original sources, and before I decide on this, I want to read the document myself.
You can search yourself. You can search yourself. It's very easy. Just type in what I typed in. You'll find.
Normally, when we provide information to our audience, we provide them a link so they don't have to go search.
Well, yeah.
So after the show, you'll provide the link, right?
We'll try.
Excellent.
We'll find it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Getting back
important.
To the moon.
Yeah, the moon.
All right. The photos that you have in item number two, which is a very strange picture of Aldrin, they're part of the official releases. So you're saying all that stuff in the bottom of that crater is really junk, really mechanical objects, right?
Yes, exactly. And
okay.
Fortunately, I've been able to track down the high-resolution photo that was in the NASA archives over the last couple of days. So I'll be doing a part two.
Well, that is that big crater that Neil Armstrong flew over when he saw the things on the rim. And then he went back and walked back to it during the EVA and took close-up photographs. So that's why we have those photos.
But look closely at the main photo. It looks like there's a floor. It looks like a floor collapsed. And there's a cavern, a cave that's going in. You see the straight line, horizontal, the horizon?
Well, in other areas of the moon, and I've looked at a lot of the Apollo images, it looks like the astronauts, like Apollo 12, landed at an ancient ruin. There's a Stonehenge 2 on the rim.
Yes.
If you dig down beneath the surface with anything significantly energetic, like a big meteor impact or a steam shovel, you would find that there is structure buried beneath the regolith, not crashes, but actual objects that are on the surface that have been buried by other eons of meteorite dust infall. So, yeah, there's a lot of structured stuff beneath the surface. That's why the lunar seismometers rang like bells when we impacted rocket stages, because there's a lot of structure beneath the surface, not just overhead. The moon is nothing like we've been told. Nothing.
Right.
That's the thing you got to get your mind around.
Anybody?
Yes. Yeah, Ron. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have a copy of that picture as well, because it's been around for a while.
We all do.
Robert
knows
this. Yeah. And Keith Laney made a big deal out of that particular image. I remember back when he was actively participating in that. And But it's readily available. And right now I'm prowling through my computer to find where I've got my stuff stored, because I can't show anybody anything because I got no way to send it to you. But I can simply look under Apollo here and find that image, and I can tell you what it was, because it's a the image number, if anybody wants to go look for it, you know, basically.
I found two other photographs which make it a panoramic, and the one that's taken farther to the left has far more detail and is in sharper focus, and the one that's on the far left is a photo of a rectangular trench. Very unusual. It's not a crater. It looks like a trench with a central rectangular hole dug up, and it doesn't look like it was dug up by astronauts. It's really unusual. The whole area is very unusual.
It is. I just found another one of it. Yeah, it's Apollo 11, and it's they have changed the number, the storage numbers of these things.
Okay, this is the number that Robert has posted from NASA headquarters. The other archives have different numbers, but if you look,
that's right.
If you look for, right, if you look for 69-HC-881, that's the image that Buzz signed, and that's the image that Robert has displayed. And as I said, there are numbers of archives where these images have different numbers, but you can get around that because you simply stay with one archive. That's all. So.
Yeah, just do some detective work. It does. I found the others have different numbers in the Apollo archives, different magazines. But look for the
surface.
Look,
they're
surface
doing on purpose.
There's also another interesting situation, which I touched on decades ago. If we have stuff originally on the moon that was in the sky, like what we're seeing on the Odysseus imagery, at some point that's going to come down. You know, meteorites are going to sever cables. They're going to sever supports. Big chunks are going to fall to the surface. And then they'll be covered up by more debris. And then there'll be an impact, and they'll be uncovered. So, yeah, we're looking at the moon as a ancient, incredibly ancient landscape filled with junk. And you don't have to dig down very far to find more junk, because the moon was occupied, and it was occupied for an immense amount of time by God knows who, probably several different who's, extending over an amazing amount of millions, if not longer, years. And so I'm not surprised that that's where they landed, because that's where they felt they might find something on the first mission.
Now, here's another element that's intriguing. Yeah, Ruggiero, you have a question?
Just briefly, I've done a little analysis on that picture that you've you sent, and when you do the upper contrast, all the geometry of whatever is in front of very odd rocky structures which look like junk, they all come out. So perhaps on another occasion I can share that with the group.
Oh, that would
yeah,
be
here's
great.
Another version of it, Apollo 11-13-1.
Apollo 11-13-1?
Hmm, that's a short number. Yeah, and it's
that's
got
a different one.
Oh, wait, here, well, okay, here we are. Here's, and underneath it, because this is a picture of the entire frame from the negative, I guess, and it's AS11-40-5954, and that was written on there by hand by somebody.
Well, we'll have to explore. But before we go on, I want to say, you know, my field is psychology, and when I saw this photograph signed by Aldrin on his Twitter page, I said, "What is he doing?" You know.
Obviously, trying to point out something like Emily Dickinson.
Yes, but I think it's his subconscious mind that put it out there, because we know that they were subjected to MK Ultra techniques to suppress the memory and suppress the telling of it. And so I hope that when Aldrin reads this article, it will spark his memory. I think that there was
then we could have another Bart Seibel moment.
Oh, that guy needs another punch in the head.
Come visit Robert and punch him in the face. I mean,
no, I don't know. That guy, he's pathetic. I mean, he's a real con man. But anyway, I felt that there was a psychological urge on the part of Aldrin to put it out, because it's a call maybe a call for help. I want to remember. So by putting this article out and another one, part two, because these other photographs that I found are even sharper. One of them has a white pentagon, a star. Like the Texas star is right there in metal, in the middle of the pile. And then there's the interior of the cavern and a section that looks like wall, like a solid wall.
There is a section that most people will notice looks like a wall. If you put aside your...
Thanks for sharing.
You're
welcome.
Yes, I'm looking forward to your sketches of the studies. We'll see if we can work out with the enhancements. So psychologically, I think, as I said, Buzz Aldrin is in his golden years, and like a California gold prospector, he's laid some gold on our laps, and we have to go and collect it and see what more is left there. But I hope that it will spark his memory and break the hold of mind control, because I would say to Buzz Aldrin, if he's listening, the oaths that you made to keep silence were made to another government, and the government that is in control now is not worthy of your loyalty. Your loyalty, Mr. Aldrin, is to the American people and to the U.S. Constitution. The time has come to speak.
Well, one of the problems of Buzz, and I think that's why he socked Seibel, I think with all the messing of their minds that was done, and I actually was at the home of one of the doctors that was mm-hmm. involved, CIA, when I was in Wyoming, and I made my moon presentation, and they were shocked, and they took me into a side room, and they threatened me, and that told me that this was very high level. But one of those doctors was involved in literally the mind control techniques and drugs that were used to keep them from remembering what they saw. So it may be subliminal. It may be he's trying to nudge his own memories, and you know, it's like Bean, because he was the artist and he could bypass the right brain controls on logic and memory. I think he slipped easily beyond the controls into his left brain artistic mode, and that's why. And Andrew, did you check out the dates? Because his transition to a much more interesting moon seems to have occurred right around the time when we held our National Press Club press conference in 96, and the Washington Post called him up and asked him about a whole bunch of stuff on the moon, and he claimed there was nothing like what we said was there, but his artwork after that began change.
Yeah,
I'd like to say that they were not victimized, as we would think, somebody imposing mind control. They were seduced into it. And I know this from a U.S. Air Force captain whose father was in the aeromedical development division of NASA to develop the spacesuits and the life support systems. So they were lured into it by being told, listen, your knowledge is national security. Yeah.
Hey, guys, we're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning, Robert Morningstar, Andrew Curry, Ron Gerbron. Keith had to leave us because he has an early morning call. When we get into the next hour, I'm going to talk about this incredible eclipse miracle. And I'll define what I mean by that when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Don't touch that archaic dial.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes.
Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. Midnight, the witching hour in the land of enchantment here. The moon is set. It's dark out there. But it's spring. We had an almost record high today up in the 70s. It's only April. It's April 13th. Actually, technically now it's April 14th. So this is a Saturday night, Sunday morning edition of The Other Side of Midnight. I want to talk about this miracle, because I want to demystify the miracle. As many of you may remember, many years ago when I had my heart attack and Art raced in to the rescue and allowed me to experience the full hyperdimensional exposure to this audience, to the Art Bell Coast audience. And they somehow were able to fix me. I mean, I know that sounds really, you know, there's prayer circles, there's prayer groups, there's intensified, you know, Harvard has done studies on medicine where people prayed and they found there really is statistically a difference between people that are not affected by other consciousness focusing on their well-being and those that are. So on Thursday, Friday of last week, I learned, shockingly, that one of my dearest friends, Dana Balaban, nephew, her brother's son, 5 years old, had been stricken with something that resulted in a perforated colon, him violently throwing up, them taking him to the hospital, and literally in the exam room going into cardiac arrest and dying. And they resuscitated him, and this all took place 6 weeks ago. And this kid, this five-year-old, bright, bubbly, interested in space travel and astronomy and, you know, the stuff we talk about here, has been in a coma for 6 weeks. So on Friday, I had arranged to do a hour interview for a young guy named Spiro Skouros, who is Nick Skouros' nephew. Nick and Dana used to be an item. That's how I know Nick and Dana. They're no longer together, but obviously it's an extended family, so there's great concern. Well, I did Nick's nephew's show on tape on Friday evening, and then as I was preparing to do it, I got a call from Clyde Lewis, and they wanted me to do an hour on the eclipse. So I did Spiro's show. Then about an hour and a half later, I did Clyde's show. And on Clyde's show, who has millions of listeners, second only to Coast and George, I laid out the problem with little Michael Balaban, Dana's nephew, that he had been in this coma for 6 weeks. And I said, based on my experience back when Art intervened with the audience and did something hyperdimensionally, and here I am, I said to myself, I wonder if I can do the same thing, get the audience, Clyde's audience, to focus during the time of the eclipse on Michael. If literally the fact that I've got measurements that show that aligning the sun, the moon, and the earth does things, creates tremors in the force. I mean, look at my item number 14 in my section. This is a color graphic I made up from Accutron measurements I made during the several hours long run up and then the eclipse and then the afterwards to the annular eclipse back in 2012. And this is very important because right in the middle of the graphic, you'll see there are green lines going up and green lines going down. Up in the graph, a lower frequency. Down is a higher frequency. That's how the program was written. I didn't write it. I would have done it the opposite way. Anyway, right in the middle of the graph, you'll see that there is a lower line with a lot of spiky stuff going down, meaning up in frequency. And then right midway in the graph, and I'll click on it and I'll read you exactly what it says. It says, let me do this properly. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Here we are. Okay. It says halfway to mid-eclipse. At 7:09:04 p.m., the frequency of the little accutron, remember it's got a tuning fork and that's how we're measuring inertial changes. The tuning fork normally is a 360, give or take. The frequency when the moon's edge crossed the middle of the sun, this is important geometry, it flipped, it plunged from 360 down to 326 hertz cycles per second and change. And it stayed there for like a minute or two before coming back up to a new midpoint of 359.85 hertz, down from 360.20 hertz. So it had this incredible excursion when the edge of the moon, where the dome is, by the way, would touch optically the center of the sun 93 million miles away. So in Las Vegas, that moment, remember, Las Vegas was never in totality. So the moon would encroach, encroach, encroach. It would come to a point on the sun where about half the sun was covered. Then it would appear to retreat and finally disappear, move off the sun. At that center moment, when it was hovering between the two hemispheres of the rotating moon, remember we're dealing with three-dimensional celestial bodies, and the three-dimensional rotating sun, at that moment, at 11:20 in Las Vegas, that's when I told Dana and her prayer circles and groups and all the people that she had basically attached to this project to try to save Michael, to get him out of his coma by praying him well. I told Clyde's audience to do their focusing on Michael at the time of the maximum eclipse in Las Vegas, where he was in a hospital bed, because that's when the numbers, when the measurements say the moon-sun alignment flips from one frequency to the radical opposite frequency. And because of the geometry of the Vegas part of the eclipse, it would hang there, covering, just touching the center of the sun for several long minutes. Okay? So you got that in mind. All right, I want to read you something. I want to go and I want to find Dana's email, where she described to me what happened at that exact moment. In fact, let me do it here so I can find it quicker. Sometimes the search mechanisms on Yahoo do not work very well. So here we are. All right. She said, incredible change with my nephew. I wanted to let you know the incredible progress we all made, and hopefully this is misspelling here. Nick sent, she'll reach out and give me more data. She says, my little nephew was turning his head and kicking his legs at the time the eclipse was at the 11:20 part, which is where we really jumped on and were focusing, because within an hour after that, I got the text from my brother George that he is moving. He's conscious. He's interacting. In other words, the coma, which had lasted 6 weeks for this little kid because of the horrible medical perfusion of his body with the poisons of his perforated colon, he came out of it exactly at the peak of the eclipse in Las Vegas, as all of these people, both Dana's circles and the folks I talked to on Clyde's show on Friday night, were focusing their energies to bring this kid back to life. And I don't have any further information except to say that the numbers and the story and the response all fit in with my own experience, which is during these alignments and when there are not alignments, depending upon factors we don't know yet, human minds can band together, can focus on an individual, and can somehow, through the modality of the hyperdimensional model, literally retrieve their consciousness and bring them back to the 3D world. And that happened with Michael on Monday afternoon. Anybody?
Yes, Richard.
Yes,
Robert. I had a similar experience. About 10 days ago, one of my best students, an Israeli, had to leave and go to Tel Aviv. He told me his father was dying. And I've known him and his father for 25 years. His father's 90 years old. And I was fully expecting that it would be a very tragic homecoming. So we got together yesterday after his return, full of jet lag. And I said to him, "Did your father pass away?" He said, "No. Why are you always trying to kill my father?" So the point is, I said to him, "Listen, as the eclipse was happening, I was here at the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, which is where we train, and I prayed for your father. And I took the energy of the eclipse and I channeled it to you. And I was thinking that I was channeling it to you at the funeral." He said, "My father," I said, "every time you go, he's gone there several times expecting his father to pass away. And every time he goes, he arrives and I do Tai Chi and I say prayers and send energy. But this one was really amplified by the eclipse. And the eclipse had an effect on me. I suffered a very, very bad injury about 7 weeks ago, and I feel like I've been in hell for 7 weeks. Dislocated fingers, sprained wrist, and a pinched nerve in my upper thoracics. And the eclipse, which I had my back to during this whole ceremony, caused my spine to burn like it was on fire that night. And it seems like it has refused my spine. And today's the first day I've been able to sleep soundly.
Oh, my God.
Since 7 weeks ago. Yeah. It was really... And the fire. See, this thing about energy during the earthquake, I was awakened by the earthquake because my bed started to rumble.
You mean the one in Jersey? About a week ago.
Yeah, the one in Jersey.
No.
And I woke up and my bed covers had slipped off and the bed was vibrating. Ha! And I just grabbed them and I pulled them back on and I tried to go back to sleep. Then I felt like my whole back and my arms were in a frying pan, literally, like I was frying. And I feel that there was some kind of burst of tectonic energy that came out and literally fried me. But on Monday, the eclipse, when I came home and went to sleep, it was only my spine, and my spine felt like it was on fire. So there is a tremendous amount of cosmic energy, prana, chi, to be harnessed and to be applied to self-healing and to healing others.
Well, the thing I would like to do, and of course we don't have the power of the eclipse to work with, but I've not been able to tell Clyde yet. I've really been waiting for doctors to kind of come in and talk about the kid before and the kid after, because I don't want to mislead people. So I've been very, very reticent. But tonight I got another email, and Michael Balaban is definitely acting much more like a five-year-old kid after 6 weeks of being, can you imagine being a kid in a coma? And then you wake up and it's like, he didn't know what was going on. And it was like all these people were standing around and he's like, what? Because obviously he did not know what had happened to him. He just lost consciousness. But yeah, if we can do this with one kid and an eclipse, what if all of us got together and tried to change what's going on in the Middle East and Ukraine? And the way you do it is you don't foreordain the ending. You pray, you focus, you zoom in on the outcome that will be the best for the most people, meaning hostilities cease, but you don't get into blaming and all that. You just want a situation to be restored. And I have a feeling the way the physics works, it kind of seeks like energy its own level. And so if you frame a general, this situation must get radically better, and don't define better. The physics will define better. People who have not talked to each other in decades will suddenly be able to pick up the phone. And in other words, it's all about people. It's all about consciousness and people. And I said to someone, well, I want to do this next. And they said, oh, there's no way you can do that. And I said, well, did you think that we'd be able to reach in and fix Michael? No. It's only impossible until it happens.
Right. I agree with you. Norman Vincent Peale, the power of positive thinking is real.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Did you have one of those little books that he wrote like my mom did?
No, I only read his biography.
My mother was, you know.
You know what's a tragedy? He was lionized. And he was lionized and he was respected, but once he said that the power of positive thinking could heal mental illness, psychiatry came down on him and was ostracized.
He was threatening their bottom line.
Exactly. But we have to believe.
Your
story about Robert, yes, sir.
Just to say, I'll touch on that point in medicine, psychology, et cetera, if we have a thought, it shouldn't be able to have a effect on your body. So if you have a very uplifting, optimistic, creative thought, a well-being thought, you'll just be flooded with good endorphins, right? Chemicals, it has a chemical change.
That's what they're saying.
If you have a negative thought, then it's destructive on the body. You just got to see people in very long-term stress situations. So words really shouldn't have effects. Our mind, you know, whatever word we have should just be neutral, but we know it's not. So I think what you're touching on is interesting.
You're absolutely right. And also the power of the thought to heal or to harm, proven by the secret life of plants. Remember the man who did the experiments with plants, when he prayed over them, they thrived and were vital, and then walked over to a plant and cursed it, and the plant died. I had a similar experience with an avocado. I had an avocado, a huge one, on top of my refrigerator with a lot of leaves sprouting, and the lower ones were brown, right? So then I would jump and grab it, and then there was one I couldn't get, and I just yelled at it, why can't you just fall off? And all of them fell off.
Oh, no.
I was heartbroken.
Oh, of course you were.
And the thing died, you know? And then I took the seed and I planted it again on the windowsill, and I would go and wash my dishes and say, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry I did that. I was so stupid. And, you know, I kept doing it and kept doing it. And then at the end of summer, it sprouted another stem. And now the avocado forgave me, and I say, if an avocado can forgive me, why can't you?
Exactly. Exactly.
Really. And this is like the resurrection of baby Jesus that you're talking about, you know? Absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
The resurrection of the avocado.
Well, there is life force, and life reanimates itself. And
well, you remember, of course,
with positive thinking.
You remember, yeah. You know, the Lazarus story,
right? Jesus was not the first one to rise from the dead. Lazarus, and then there was a daughter of Jairus who had died, and he brought her back. So this idea of resurrection is real.
Well, if you look at number 14, you look at all that activity, and I chose where it all flips. It goes from negative to positive, or positive to negative, depending on your definition. And I felt, and Ron and I had an earlier conversation earlier in the week about this, kind of obliquely, because my thinking was, it isn't so much the energy, it's the change, the step function. And if they caught the wave when the whole physics was changing dynamically from negative to positive vibration, then that would be a basic change in the system. It's kind of like, you know, when your electronics don't work and like any good Russian, you take a hammer and you hit it and it starts working. In other words, yep. Michael received a reset from all those people focusing carrier, piggybacking on the carrier HD wave of this magic alignment when the edge of the moon was just straddling between left rotation and right rotation. And it worked. I don't know how physically, you know, I mean, we can back engineer, but again, if something so simple can work, what if one were to envision something much more significant affecting thousands or millions of people, like this horrible, you know, creeping famine, starvation? Mm-hmm. Millions of people in Gaza are going to die because they don't have more than 200 or so calories per day at the moment. This is awful, and the only thing that can change awful based on this experience is people deciding to change awful.
Agreed.
May I introduce a cautionary note?
Oh, sure. Ron always loves to introduce cautionary notes. Go ahead.
Yes. Speaking of our arguments, I wondered if it's the one with the knives or the ones with the dueling pistols, but I'm not sure which. Now, when it comes to these thought experiments, now, I am a believer. I know they work. And this is something I told Richard before.
Well, I'm here because the one with me worked. The doctors had told Robin behind the scenes that basically I was going to die. She just needed to get ready. And I didn't die.
They always work. We know.
Well, you can say like the experiment that's positive, you don't remember the ones where it didn't work.
That's true as well. But here's it. No, there is a caution. There is a cautionary note here. And sometimes people get away with it and sometimes they don't. But I devoutly believe in this. And I should say that maybe it runs to the family a little bit because my mother, who didn't express any particular aptitudes in these things, she could take a burnt piece of a stick and grow a tree out of it. I mean, I've never seen anybody that was better at just saying, oh, well, I'll just put this in some water until it sprouts. You know, for her, it always worked. Well, some people are tuned in. Everybody has the potential.
So wait. You're saying you left me in the dust. I don't know what to believe. You're saying that your mother had talents you were not aware of, and when she put the little burnt stick in the soil or the water and et cetera, that her focusing on it made the difference, right?
Yes, that seemed to have a positive. Yeah,
okay.
The burnt stick part is a bit of an elaboration, but you get the idea.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you could say, oh, well, we could never sprout this, but for some reason, she always could, you know, and just kind of took it for granted. The point is, the first time that Art did his thought experiment, his mass thought experiment, it was very well organized. Everybody was supposed to go outside during the commercial break, and so not to miss the show, and concentrate on joining in the mass consciousness and then directing it. And when I went outside, you know, because of his listenership and so forth, I could feel the psychic overpressure in the sky, you know, And I said, oh, this is interesting. Well, the thing is, if you can detect it, if you can feel it, and this is pure shamanism, which not everybody attunes to, if you're capable of comprehending it on that level, then you can manipulate it. So it's just as easy to use that same collected energy if it's done in a random and chaotic fashion, which is kind of the thing that Clyde was, you were helping Clyde with, then you run just as much danger as benefit. Now, nobody wanted to kill
We only got about a couple minutes left to the bottom. What do you mean danger?
Well, then why? Then if you're going to use it up, I can't finish the point.
What
but
do you
ahead.
Mean by danger? What's the downside?
I think I just said that. Hmm?
No, you didn't. What's the danger?
If you want to, if everybody wants to make somebody healthy, fine. But like in the case of, there was an awful lot of attention devoted to you, and you were thinking that some of the people involved, this is your personal bit of this that I thought of when I was talking to you. I had a sort of a remote viewing experience in the midst of that, and I was tuning in on wherever some of this energy was coming from. And what I got was an image that was very much like the bunker arrangement where the government's remote viewing experiments were being done. And you were saying, oh, well, you know, this might have been the, you know, the source of it. And I know you have another channel with, you know, people that have said they recognize where it might have been coming from. And I'm not disputing or that in any way. But I think I might have picked up on some people that I was even assuming were the bad guys, but they were participating, trying to help you. The point is that if you're trying these mass experiments, you do have to be cognizant of the fact that there could be danger, because if somebody has evil thoughts in the same direction that you're trying to counteract, they could use that same energy, because you have to focus it, and that takes a shaman, shamanic sense.
I don't know whether
you that's a focus.
I don't know whether I believe any of that. You know why? Because the Clyde experiment was very unfocused. Clyde does not do this all the time.
Yes.
I surprised him. All he did was plant the idea. I told them, don't do it now, but wait till the eclipse. And the kid's talking. You know, it's like
because of the eclipse.
I do not agree. Yes, it was because of the eclipse. It was because the eclipse provided the focus. If the alignments, as I've measured, amplify these energies to where they're blatantly obvious, then you have to assume in the model that the consciousness energies are also amplified. And if you wonder about the polarity, there's a lot more positive people out there than negative people. And the positives, if they focus, they will win. Okay, we are at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is our usual argumentative Ron, Andrew Curry, who's being very quiet, Robert Morningstar, who's contributed some really interesting stuff. And we're going to spend another half hour talking about the eclipse that was and what's going to come again. Because remember, we live in the future, not the past. How can we take these lessons of what the moon represents, of what an eclipse now represents, and how can we focus on creating the kind of world that we want to live in when we return?
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcasters to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone. Last half hour to go on this Saturday night, the 13th of April of 2024. You know, the problem that Ron raises is very serious, because I thought about a lot of this, particularly when I turned out to be the beneficiary, and I can say that, of his audience and their incredible intentions. And I've met so many people over the years who said, yeah, I knew that. I was part of that, you know, and nice you're still here. Yes, I'm still here. And Michael Balaban is now here and conscious and breathing and interacting, and he recognizes his dear Aunt Dana. That stands for something.
Yes?
Okay, back to our conversation. Andrew, you've been very, very quiet. I'm not going to let you sit there and not have an opinion on this. So come forth, please.
Yeah, two things, Richard. I'll make this really short. So
we have half an hour. You don't have to make it really short. Everybody always wants to make their stuff short. How can you make something interesting short? If we don't finish, we'll pick it up on the next show, that kind of thing. That's the magic of having this show. I can do any number of repeats on things that we need to focus on. So go for it.
Well, in terms of this idea that, you know, if someone focuses on you and can make a change. So I personally had an experience last year, early 2023. Robert knows about it, where I had this really horrible allergic reaction in my body to something, and literally my legs swelled up like to the size of tree trunks. I could barely walk, and I was still under the, you know, pressure of getting work done. And it was one night I had to get a deadline done, and I'm pretty tough when it comes to not, you know, running to a doctor for every single little thing. I could, you know, like Robert and I talk about this, just do home remedies and take care of yourself kind of thing and keep yourself in shape and all that kind of stuff. Well, this is one of the few times where I literally started to feel like, I literally went up to my older son and I said, hey, Quinlan, I said, you know, I usually don't panic, but you might have to take me to the hospital because I'm feeling something tremendously wrong within me. And so he kind of looked at me stunned and I said, but I got to get this deadline done first. So I went
Andrew.
Downstairs and I kept working.
I can see the line on your tombstone now.
No.
I had one more line to draw.
Oh, Richard, yeah. it was terrible. It felt like a storm was happening on my insides and everywhere. And
well, it sounds like
anyways,
Robert. It sounds like Robert's problem.
Well, my wife and my youngest son, Stellan, who by the way had this incredible dream about the eclipse, which I didn't get a chance to record, and I do one point soon if we come back on the show. I'd love to share it with the audience. It was very interesting. But anyways, I called them because they were coming back from something, and I sort of explained the situation. I said, please pray for me. And they were like, whoa. So
wait a minute, you told your family pray for you?
Yeah, it just came into my
Holy
head.
Holy cow.
And I hung up, and I kept working, and I was sweating, I was panicking because it was starting to, something was wrong. And then all of a sudden, within a few minutes after I had hung up the phone with them, it went away like a cloud. The whole feeling started to dissipate. And I looked around the room, I go, what just happened? And it all calmed down. I mean, I still was suffering from this allergic reaction, but the whole, like moving to that tipping point where I was about to, something bad was going to happen, it was gone. And when they got home, I said, what did you do? And Anna said, and Anna's a Catholic. She was raised a Catholic. She's
Anna,
not a
Anna's Catholic. Your wife.
Yes. And she said, we did Hail Marys for you. And I think she had the rosary in the truck because she has
my.
It usually. Yeah. It's very interesting.
Well, it's all about connection. To me, part of this has to do with connection, because when Art helped his audience save me, the audience and I had a connection. If I really did help Clyde and his audience save Michael, or at least affect him, it's because the audience has a connection to Michael through me. It's all about connectivity.
Yeah.
It's all connectivity because it's about resonance. The physics is about resonant frequencies. And that's why I can listen to Robert and say I can go with that, because I know, having been subjected to the magic of the Force, I know what can be done if people are allowed to use it and focus. And so much of our life is all about distraction and noise and not focusing or taking a pill.
Well, and it's got to make you wonder, Richard, if there's a deep state, or if they're, whatever the side that doesn't really like humanity very well or very much, and it seems like there is something
and
there.
And is trying to keep us from re-engaging with these tools.
Yeah, exactly. That if there is somebody or something that is aware of this, then, spiking the system with a lot of nonsense and, as you say, just scrambling the airwaves is an easy way to keep us disconnected. I mean, Ron and I have had these conversations.
I saw network correspondents who've covered everything crying on live television, looking up and seeing this spectacle and musing about, oh, the coincidence. What will they be doing when they realize it's not a coincidence? It's part of our designer nursery.
Well, Richard, here's a question for you. I want to swing back to two things. Back to the idea of the moon dome, which I believe I
feel not belief, it's science, it's engineering.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah.
Well, I agree, and I know not everybody here is on the same page.
Let's do a little kind of spot poll. Let us do a little spot poll here. All right, Andrew is yes, there's a dome. Hoagland, yes, there's a dome. Ron, is there a dome? Yes or no?
No.
There's no dome. Okay. Robert, is there a dome?
I prefer the word sheath to the dome, but there's something there.
Okay. Ruggiero?
Floating structure.
See, it doesn't matter what we call it. It's there. It doesn't mind.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't.
Those are both good answers, the last two, that I could say, yes, that's a good direction to look. The idea of the snow globe is the only one that I don't buy, because I can't rationalize the engineering involved, and there is one other example of it where it clearly didn't work, which just goes to show that no matter how bright people think they are, they can screw something up by leaving something important out.
You will tell
us.
You, hang on. You will describe exactly what you're talking about, right? Because at the moment, I haven't a clue.
Yeah, I know.
Then tell
us. It out. Okay, there are many. Many examples easily found in architecture where big, tall buildings, excuse me, I'm going to cough, were designed, funded, and built, and they forgot to put in the elevator shaft. So they had to put it on externally. In one case, they built an office building that was like 30 stories high, and they forgot about the bathrooms.
How does one do that?
Can get... You got me, but
would you like to drink some water? I would go get some.
No, there's none handy.
Then take some time, take a minute or two, go get some water, because listening to you strangle on the air is not fun.
Uh-oh. I know, you'd rather do it in person. Okay, all right, I'll be back in a moment.
Okay. Robert.
Oh, Richard.
Yeah, go ahead.
Wait, Richard, on that, I wanted to share one more thing. I mentioned Greg Ahrens, who, again, friend of the show, researcher, colleague, and he did send in an email, really interesting. I'm going to read it out if you don't mind.
Oh, by all means.
Okay, so he says, regarding the red coloring around the shadow of the moon, and he has quotation marks around red, here is a link, not I, hopefully we can post this. It's very interesting. Here is a link to a photo on a Facebook taken during last week's eclipse. It shows a 360-degree sunset from under the totality.
Exactly. That's the one I was going to post, and I couldn't get to it because Keith was too busy, so I figured we'd just describe it.
Yeah. The photo was taken in Arkansas between 1 and 2 p.m. when there should be, when there should not be any sunset. Then there's a photograph, and it's a 360, one of those 360-degree. It's really cool, right? You just use your mouse to kind of...
Okay, we will post this in your items when Keith is conscious again, and he can post something.
Okay. P.S. I also witnessed, this is Greg, a 360-degree sunset when I was in totality at my house in Columbia. M.O. What is M.O.?
Missouri.
That's what I thought. Missouri in 2017. I didn't realize then that it was an artifact of the lunar dome. So it's a very interesting photograph.
Stunning. So he'll send it to you. You got it, right?
Yeah.
We will post it for the 19.5 archive for future listeners, because it's exactly... I feel so stupid, because when I stop to think, it's like, why would we ever have thought of comparing the shadow and the colors around the shadow to sunset when it's nowhere near sunset? Geometrically, it's almost 90. In other words, it proves the moon has a dome. Regardless of what you want to call it, I've likened it to wrapping the moon in saran wrap. The relative thickness of the dome, 20 miles, compared to the 2,160-mile diameter of the moon, it's almost like navel lint. It's just a film, but it has incredible optical properties, as now one of our listeners and Greg have seen. It also has incredible electrical and hyperdimensional properties. There's another member of our audience. His first name is Graham. I don't have permission to use his last name, so I won't. But he did a very detailed analysis, which I'm going to post in my section as one of my items, of the lunar waves, all the videos showing these weird waves going between the poles of the moon. Remember those? I have them as in my items tonight. It's number 10, number 11. Okay, number 10 is a detail, and 11 is our analysis. The shock waves are moving at like 200 miles per second through this, whatever it is, the dome. That's an astonishing rate of acceleration and movement for a physical structure. So then I asked, is it electro-optically active so that a wave appears, but the wave is merely elements rotating so you see a reflection, as opposed to not rotating so you don't see a reflection? So it's kind of like an illusion. It isn't really a physical wave. It's a wave being created by someone turning things off and turning them on in the dome in succession at a rate that looks like a 200-mile-per-second velocity. However...
It's a flashlight effect?
Yeah, kind of. Okay.
Like when you shine a flashlight on a barn or something like that, and it moves it at an incredible speed because of the... vector. I would buy into that.
It has to be a physical effect in the dome. Some computer has to be triggering these panels to come on and come off at a certain angle and a certain time. So Graham, I want to get back to Graham, who's one of our devoted listeners, who's a really interesting technical guy. He took and he measured all the videos I'd presented. I think I presented three or four, taken from 2012 up until I think a couple of years ago. That was the latest I could find in the time I had available to find it. And he did measurements and calculations. And in each of these appearances, there are two waves that appear. Sometimes they appear right together, like back to back, and sometimes there's a long, 30-second pause between the end of the first wave and the beginning of the second wave. But he measured them all, and he found, let me go back to his conclusion, which is really, really important. In fact, it's so important, I'm going to find and quote exactly what he says here, because this is so Amazing. G-R-A-H. Okay, there we are. All right. And we'll find it. It's going to come up on my screen. Oh, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. No, it's not coming up on my screen. Okay. Well, I have to do this. I have to do this. Why can't I find this easily? Every time you're trying to find something on live radio easily, weird things happen, so you can't find it. But I do want to quote this accurately because it is so dramatic. Okay, here we are. Here we are. Here's what he said. He said, a study of the videos listed below shows the lunar wave phenomenon has inspired a theory to predict their occurrence. About 3 days before the full moon, he says, in early evening when amateur astronomers are actively filming the moon, a double wave phenomenon has been observed and recorded on multiple occasions, racing at roughly 300 kilometers per second from one lunar polar region to the other lunar polar region. But here's where things get really weird. The total time from the initiation of the first wave to termination of the second wave seems to be nearly constant over all the measurements I've done at 19.5 seconds. Let me repeat that. Each of these waves varying from 7 to 17 seconds in transit time, the interval between the waves within each set is 19 and a half seconds. That is not an accident. Thoughts?
Can you elaborate on what that means, Richard? Obviously,
someone's doing it. Someone's doing it for a reason. They're doing it with the numerical code 19.5 to let us know, A, it's the physics, and B, someone's doing it. It's not nature. And our job now is to find out who is on the moon, who is activating the dome, who is causing these transit waves, and why do they keep incorporating over and over again 19.5 seconds in their demonstrations, unless it's to inform us on Earth that this is going on.
Why couldn't it be a reflexive thing?
19.5 seconds?
I don't mean reflection. I mean reflexive. Like
19,
there's nobody doing
19.5 seconds.
I get that part. I get that part. I get that part. That's fine.
No,
but
it's not. It's impossible. A reflexive triggering would not be repetitive in terms of time in each of the separate sets compared to each other. In other words, even though the intervals are different for each phenomenon, the interval between the first wave and the second is always 19.5. That's still a
good metronomic. What if it's metronomic? You found the metronome of the universal
No.
That's plausible.
The physics, no. I think I know something more about HD physics than anybody here. That's not the way it works.
Yeah, but you're...
That's not the way it works. It's not a natural frequency. It's not a natural phenomenon. Someone's doing this.
Something set up by someone is causing this to be visible under certain circumstances. But that doesn't mean that they're there on a moment-to-moment basis monitoring or reacting.
And you know that how?
By inference, the same way that you're coming up with this. It's not a you're inferring that somebody is actively...
Yes,
doing
of course.
This, which means that they have to be aware of your perceiving it.
No, all they have to be aware of is
looking.
All they have to be aware of is this is a natural constant, and they keep like some Morse code. They keep tapping out the same message. This is important. This is important. Remember,
okay,
all
fine.
Of this,
the circumstances
all of this
are tapping
is,
out the message.
All of this is in a very Emily Dickinson way. Instead of taking out a billboard or taking out time on NBC. They do it this way.
The lying poet.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not opposed to the circumstance. I'm just saying that I don't think somebody is actively activating it on behalf of your or anyone else's viewing of it. It's just it's something that's set up.
Why would you say
that?
Well, you have zero evidence that there's nobody there. Normally, when we see an intelligent activity.
I didn't say there was nobody there. But, I mean, what
And you don't
what
think they're
they?
Doing this deliberately, then?
I don't think it's happening deliberately because we happen to be looking at it right now. No.
Do you know how many people look at the moon constantly with telescopes or without all over the earth these days?
I'm one.
Thousands, millions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to catch somebody's attention, you do it this way. It goes on to something called the internet or social media. People start talking about it, and then the in crowd goes, uh-oh, something is leaking. Somebody is doing something we don't want. Because, of course, there are folks on the moon. There are folks. Have you ever heard of the secret space program?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so if they are messing with this incredibly advanced tech, including doing something that triggers literal waves in this dome racing from pole to pole at hundreds of miles per second, that's pretty damn good technology. And they're impressing upon that construct the 19.5 signature. Obviously, they're trying to say, this is HD physics, HD physics, HD physics, which then goes to the bigger point, which is, if we live in a designer solar system and we have actual active planetary bodies that, in addition to their natural alignments and masses and spins, have hyperdimensional technological appurtenances, what was the role, back to Novi, what was the role of the dome around the moon? Is it in part designed to, if you energize it, it changes the entire Earth-Moon system, including life on Earth, including consciousness, including things like what brought Michael out of his coma?
Or is it a side effect of a giant microwave oven cooking pizzas?
And would you like to know the answer?
Yes, I
do. Good.
I object to the somewhat religious version.
I know where to What's religious about a library? We just need to go and find the libraries, and we'll find all of them.
No, it's religious about perceiving demigods, demons, or gods keeping track of us on such a close leash.
They're right next door. They're looking at us. Obviously, whoever's doing this is not doing it for their own lonesome. They wouldn't need 19.5 seconds with different spacing to come out with the same number. Thank you, Graham. What's an amazing piece
They're not calibrating it differently for everybody out of 8 billion people. It's just something that's part of the system, whatever that system is. That's all. You're over contrasting.
And I do not agree at all.
Simple remark, it's not that active. Well, why not?
Because they're of different wavelengths. He has measured them from 7 to 17 seconds. But each one...
But only the one that's 19 and a half matters?
That's the only ones there are. There are no others.
You just said there were.
No, I didn't.
You said there are all different frequencies.
It's the interval between the first wave and the second wave, which is 19.5. The waves themselves...
Right. Yes.
Very
dry.
Very dry here.
I'd like to share something right now. It's very pertinent. And very important.
Sure, we got 6 minutes. Go ahead.
Robert.
It's very short. It's about the superhuman stage of entities' existence. And this is from the late John Lear. All of these abilities are part of the superhuman stage, and they are more sophisticated because they exist in a higher dimension that intersects with ours. Higher dimensional entities must focus on a tighter spectrum of vibrations in order to intercept our dimension, otherwise they will stay invisible to us. We are like fish who are oblivious to the fact that people outside of the aquarium are watching us, people who can make themselves known by tapping on the glass or sticking their fingers in the water. Despite coming from higher levels, these entities technically exist between us and that dimension. What are your thoughts?
I think it's perfect. I buy 100% of it. Yes. If there's someone who is kind of operating according to Roddenberry's prime directive, because there's lots of folks out there, not just the folks that are connected to us.
Yes, the great astrophysicist Gene Roddenberry.
Who happened to write an entire amazing television series around fundamentals of everything we talk about on this show. Now, if in fact there is a prime directive, letting us know they exist would so discombobulate the planet. Look what's going on right now tonight over Israel. If someone wanted to let us know, A, they are here, and B, they know the same physics we should know, doing lunar waves for amateurs looking at the moon with a stopwatch is an incredibly elegant way to, A, introduce the idea there's somebody bigger out here than you are, and we know the same thing you should know, and here is the magic number, which is the key to figuring out everything. It's so prime directive. And thanks again, Graham, for doing the calculations to show it.
Richard, you said a really
key. Prime directive is about non-involvement.
No, it's not about non-involvement. It's about non-intrusive involvement.
Oh.
It's letting the aliens know there are other aliens in their front yard unless they've been invited in. But you can do all kinds of things around the edge to try to educate them, to try to lift them up, to try to give them a wider perspective, including a fundamental constant that Graham found in these damn lunar waves, which is the last place I would have ever looked. Thank you, Graham.
Disputing the Graham mystery person's calculations at all. So, you know, but how long has it been?
It's not calculation, it's measurement. You simply look at the video and you see the first wave and you time it. You see the second wave, you time that, and the interval between the first one appearing and the second one.
All right, measurement. I don't care if it's surface temperature. It's a constant.
No, they're not constant.
Hey guys, we're running out of time.
Yeah, we're running out of time.
I really want to thank Greg Ahrens for that fabulous 360 photograph. And I want to thank the Other Side of Midnight audience for clicking on to the Aldrin article. I've just received word from Substack that it's reached 1,688 views in less than 24 hours. And before the show, I checked and it was 680. So thank you for tuning in, 1,000 of you.
We literally have 30 seconds. Who has something pithy that will fit in 30 seconds?
I do. What happened to the lava tubes on the moon? Which
are they lava tubes?
We're saying were terribly valuable, and now they're just forgetting that.
Are they lava
tubes? Surface.
Of course they're not.
Well, they're
lava
not.
Tubes. No.
They're not.
They're breaks in the ceiling, and you're looking down into the inhabited parts of the room of the moon, which is in one of Robert's photos from Aldrin.
We are literally
out of time. I want to thank all my guests this morning, Robert Morningstar, Andrew Curry, and Ron Gerbron. I want to thank you, and next week, not tomorrow, but next week, tomorrow is David Sirita is going to regale us with some truly amazing information on a hyperdimensional solar system. So next week, we may take up another weird thing that happened, but that's another time. So until then, same time, same bat channel. Sorry. Wow. Third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone. And we are clear. Oh, my God. My throat really gave out. We are clear.
Oh,
God, I got attacked by this terrible you know, thing. Ah.
We heard it. What happened to the nice little British lady who says, thank you for listening to Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.
I think I put her to bed, I think.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
let
good.
Me, let me go.
Oh, don't wake her up.
No, that's usually the cute. That's usually the